Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
President Trump launched another tweet storm over the weekend, this time directed at Congressman Elijah Cummings, who is African-American. The president insulted Cummings's district. It's majority black, and it includes part of Baltimore. This is just Trump's latest attack against a non-white member of Congress, and critics say it is a political tactic of stoking divisions ahead of the 2020 elections. NPR's Aisha Roscoe is following the issue and joins us from the White House. Hi, Aisha.
Hello.
Okay, just a couple weeks ago, of course, the president went after four members of Congress who are women of color and Democrats. Now he's going after Congressman Cummings, who is a Democrat leading multiple investigations into the Trump administration. Lots of people see a pattern here, singling out people of color for very personal attacks. What does the White House say about it?
So the White House and Trump campaign say that this is not intentional, that the president is simply criticizing people that he doesn't agree with, and race has nothing to do with it. Trump's acting chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, was pressed on this matter on Fox News Sunday. He had this exchange with host Chris Wallace.
These are all six members of Congress who are people of color.
I think you're spending way too much time reading between the lines.
So Mulvaney says people are looking too deeply into this, but it's Trump's specific language about these lawmakers that's drawing fire. He described Baltimore in dramatic terms, basically as a place no human being would want to live, saying it was disgusting, rat and rodent infested mess. And about 600,000 people live in Baltimore. And poverty is not limited to that city. There are plenty of towns and cities in this country who struggle with poverty, including those that have voters who generally back President Trump. But we don't see Trump criticizing those places.
Tell us about how the latest targets of these attacks are responding.
So Reverend Al Sharpton went to Baltimore. He held a press conference. Ahead of that, Trump bashed him. He claimed that Sharpton hates whites and cops and called him a con man. Sharpton had a lot to say about that.
Call me a troublemaker. Yes, I make trouble for bigots. I made trouble for him with Central Park. I made trouble with him for birtherism. I'm going to keep making trouble for bigots. As far as me being a con man, if he really thought I was a con man, he'd be nominating me for his cabinet.
And Sharpton wasn't the only one firing back. The local newspaper, the Baltimore Sun, ran an editorial that said, "Better to have some vermin living in your neighborhood than to be one," referring to Trump.
We should note that Central Park and birtherism were two other moments that Trump took a very public position against people of color, in one case, President Barack Obama. President Trump insults a lot of his opponents, including politicians. Explain how these particular insults against people of color are different. How do they stand out?
It's a particular tone that he's taken and the targets. His language about people of color who criticize him often seems to include nods to stereotypes. These tropes, go back to your country, crime-infested areas, they have a long history in America. And a cruel history. And I did a lot of reporting on this issue back last summer, cataloging hundreds of Trump's tweets. And what stood out to me going through those tweets is that Trump had praise for black celebrities and lawmakers who supported him. He would say they were smart or that they get it. But for those black people who opposed him, he would say they were dumb or low IQ and use this kind of specific language only on them.
As you say, this kind of language has been along for has been around for a long time in America. What changes when it's the president of the United States using it?
So I spoke to a Howard University professor, Greg Carr, and what he said is that it's not really just the words from Trump, that we've had politicians who've done this before, but it's the silence from Republicans and others in power who defend these words that kind of contribute to this idea that black people will be permanent outsiders and that they will never be fully accepted by this country.
That's NPR White House reporter Aisha Roscoe. Thank you.
Thank you.
The cows. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, August 1, 2019. So I have been told, feeling better. The counter-racist grind continues. This is our weekly book club, The Gift of Fear, authored by Gavin DeBecker, white male suspected racist. This is our fifth study session. We are more than halfway through the book. I think we may have three more sessions and then we will be all done. With this book, wowee. So just 2 weeks ago, we read this book and he referenced Al Sharpton, compared him to Rush Limbaugh. And it was not a comparison like, oh, what a great guy Al Sharpton is. That was not it at all. It was sounding like he was just trying to get attention. So I played it that I read, actually. I read that segment of the book last week where he mentioned Al Sharpton. And I said that I always, always, always hear white people, if they mention Al Sharpton, it is a criticism. It is death to Al Sharpton. I played the sound clip last week where literally there was a white woman who said that exactly. So, and they were doing this on the anniversary of Al Sharpton being stabbed. So lo and behold, this week, President Donald Trump talking about Congressman Elijah Cummings and that no good conman racist Al Sharpton, called him a con man and a racist. White people talking bad about Al Sharpton. It is almost 2020. And it's not just white people. The president of the United States, I'm even trying to reflect. I don't know if I ever remember any other white presidents talking bad about Al Sharpton. I don't remember either of the Bushes. If anyone recalls, first time that I can remember actual sitting president joining the furor over Al Sharpton, death to Al Sharpton, even from the White House. I put that in this week, not just because I'm on some sort of, you know, defend Al Sharpton type thing. I played it this week because we're going to get another O.J. Simpson reference this week. We had one before. I said I put that all of these together. This is coded racism. That's what they just mentioned. This is pay attention to the tone. Especially because we're not having a wealth of black people mentioned. In fact, this is all I'll say. I'll hush and we can get to the audio. Pay attention when we have these references to Al Sharpton, O.J. Simpson. We had one previously that I mentioned. We're going to get another big one this week. It's more flagrant. The one before was kind of veiled. Be mindful. And then contrast that also the movie references. That's big. I say anytime that we make analogies, comparisons, be mindful. So be mindful of what movies he thinks collectively we should have seen. The cast involved in the movie. Sometimes he's going to pick out specific actors, actresses. Who does he cite? I would say that might even give you a window into who is supposed to be reading the book. But we'll end there. Look out for O.J. Simpson. The juice, once again, in Gavin DeBecker's The Gift of Fear. This is the Cows audio segment number one.
Some statements in an interview that appear to be favorable may actually mask characteristics that are unfavorable. I am always on time, or I am very, very organized, are sometimes offered by applicants who will later be revealed as inflexible and territorial. Territorialism. My desk, my area, my assignment is not necessarily an attribute. If I say I'll give you 8 hours, you can be sure that's what you'll get, not a minute less. might be said by an applicant who will also hold you to his expectations, treating understandings as commitments and unforeseen changes as unfairnesses. We can all rationalize anything, and when an employer is too anxious to fill a position, intuition is ignored. As I mentioned earlier about hiring babysitters, the goal should be to disqualify poor applicants rather than qualify good applicants. Those who are good will qualify themselves. Another characteristic frequently seen in cases that ended badly is that the employee was not supervised appropriately. The concept of appropriate supervision can be stated in 6 words: praise for performance, correction for errors. It is as important to catch employees doing something right and tell them as it is to catch them doing something wrong. But above all, noncompliance must not be ignored. With the problem employee, supervisors have often given up on correcting him. Many of the problems that arise could have been avoided by treating this employee appropriately at every step. But people treated him differently because it was easier than resolving the issues. This type of employee is very sensitive and perceptive about being handled, particularly if it's because of a concern that he will act violently. If he perceives that employers consider him dangerous, it can actually increase the likelihood of his acting out, because he has little to lose when he's already thought of as violent. In addition to hiring the wrong people and supervising them badly, employers who had the worst outcomes were also slow to fire people they knew had to go. A problem employee is easier to terminate before he makes a substantial emotional investment in the job, before the minor issues become causes, before disappointments become disgruntlements. The longer that emotional investment is made, the stronger it becomes, and the more likely it is that the termination will be difficult. Often employers are reluctant to fire someone who concerns them because they really don't know the best way to do it. Below I list some strategies for difficult terminations, but many are also applicable to terminating other emotionally invested relationships, such as those involving unwanted suitors, business partners, and former spouses. Individual circumstances will always call for customized responses, but these philosophies will usually apply. Protect the dignity domino. Prop it up with courtesy and understanding. Never embarrass an employee. Keep secret from him any concerns you have about serious harms he might commit. Think the worst if the indicators are there, but treat the terminated employee as if he were what you hope him to be. Treat him as if he is reasonable, as if you are not afraid of how he might react. Terminate his employment in a manner that demonstrates that you expect him to accept the news maturely and appropriately. This doesn't mean ignore the hazard. Just the opposite is wise. Prepare for the worst, but not in ways detectable to the terminated employee. Don't lead him to believe that you are anticipating threats or hazard. If you do, you may be writing a script for him to follow. Further, you are letting him know your vulnerabilities. Make the termination complete. Often employers are tempted to offer a gradual separation, thinking it will lessen the blow to the terminated employee. Though it may appear that this approach extends the term of employment, it really extends the firing and the embarrassment and anxiety along with it. It is analogous to hooking someone up to life support systems when he has no quality of life and no chance for survival. Though some may believe this extends the process of life, it actually extends the process of death. Do not negotiate. This could be called the golden rule, and it applies to getting out of any kind of relationship with people who refuse to let go. Once the termination decision has been made, your meeting with the employee is to inform him of your decision, period. Other issues may come up, but don't negotiate, no matter how much he wants to. This is not a discussion of how to improve things, correct things, change the past, find blame, or start over. Revisiting the issues and contentions of his history with the company will only raise sore points and raise emotion. he cannot likely be convinced that terminating him is a good idea. It isn't in his nature to recognize that, no matter what the evidence, so keep the presentation brief. I suggest to clients that they actually write a script of the few points they want to make in informing the employee of the decision. I also suggest they come up with what my office calls a boomerang line, a sentence that can be repeated each time he tries to derail the conversation. "Bill, if you had made this decision instead of us, we'd respect it," or, "This is not the time to rehash the past. We have to work on the future." Keep the discussion future-based. Avoid rehashing the past. Establish some issues about the future to be resolved during the meeting. For example, what would you like us to tell callers about where to reach you? Would you like us to forward mail or advise the sender of your new address? How can we best describe your job here to future employers who may contact us? Make the employee feel that his input has bearing. Uncertainty about what a former employer will tell callers causes high anxiety, so address it directly and show that it is resolvable. This way, it's not left simmering beneath the surface. These points may seem minor, but they direct focus to the future, to his starting over again, rather than dwelling on the past. Be direct. Instead of simply informing an employee that the decision to fire him has been made, some employers saddle up to the issue so delicately that the person doesn't fully realize he has just been fired. After listening, he might say he understands he has to improve his performance, to which the employer responds, "No, you don't understand. We're firing you." This can make the fired employee feel foolish on top of all the other feelings that go with being fired. Trying to be delicate often results in being vague. There's a joke that seems at first to endorse delivering bad news in a roundabout way, but it shows that directness actually makes more sense. A woman calls the friend who is house-sitting for her and asks how things are going. "Well, your cat fell off the roof and died," the friend reports. "My God," the woman replies, "how could you tell me like that? You should have said Fluffy was playing on the roof, having a wonderful time, and she began to slip. She regained her footing and seemed okay, but then she slipped again and fell off the roof. She was rushed to the vet, and the injury seemed serious, but then Fluffy rallied, and everyone thought she'd make it, but, well, finally she passed away. That's how you should have told me." The house-sitter apologizes for being so unfeeling. A week later, the woman calls again to see how things are going. The house-sitter hesitates and then says, "Well, your mother was playing on the roof." People benefit most from hearing bad news forthrightly. The whole theme of the termination meeting should be that you are confident he will succeed in the future, find work he will enjoy, and do well. You may actually feel he has emotional problems, is self-defeating, and will always fail, but there is nothing to be gained from letting these messages surface. The tone of the meeting should be matter of fact, not solemn and depressing. These changes are part of professional life that we all experience at one time or another. I've been through it myself. We know you'll do well and that this needn't be a setback for you. Cite general rather than specific issues. Many employers want to justify to the terminated employee why they are taking this action, as if they could possibly convince him that his being fired is a good idea. Others use the termination meeting for more efforts to correct the employee's attitude or improve him, turning the termination meeting into a lecture. Many employers give more frank and constructive criticism at the moment of firing someone than they ever gave that employee while he was employed. Forget about that. It's too late. A wiser course is to describe the decision in general terms, saying it's best for all parties. Say employment is a two-way street, and the present situation isn't serving either side. Say he is obviously a capable person, but this job is not providing the best environment for him to excel in. Do not get dragged into a discussion about who will replace him. Use a boomerang line, or say those decisions haven't been made. Remember the element of surprise. In consideration of the security and safety of those handling the firing, the employee should not be aware of the termination meeting ahead of time. Believe it or not, many employees are summoned to their firing meeting with the words, "They're going to fire you." Time it right. A firing should take place at the end of the day while other employees are departing. This way, when the meeting is over, the fired employee cannot immediately seek out those he feels are responsible. Further, he will then be going home at the same time as usual, as opposed to finding himself home on a weekday morning, for example. I suggest firing at the end of the work week. If fired on a Friday, he has the weekend off as usual and won't feel the impact of having no place to go the next morning. Unlike on a weekday, he will not awaken with the knowledge that his former co-workers are at the job and possibly discussing him. He won't have the experience of everything being different from usual, different shows on TV, familiar people not at home, etc. Though some believe that firing earlier in the week is advisable, I find it makes possible targets of aggression available to him at work while he is still at a point of high emotion. Choose your setting. A firing should take place in a room out of the view of other employees. It should not be in the office of the person doing the firing, because then there's no way to end the meeting if the terminated employee wants to keep talking. The person doing the firing needs to have the ability to stand up and leave if it's no longer productive to stay. One experienced executive I know avoids using his office because he feels that a person will always vividly remember where he was fired and might return there if angry. Choose your cast. Who should be present? I suggest that a higher level manager than the employee usually worked with should make the termination presentation. It should be someone distant from the day-to-day controversies that surrounded the terminated employee. It should be someone who is calm and can retain that demeanor in the face of anger or even threats. When workable, a second participant can be someone in management the fired employee is known to admire, or someone with whom he has had a good relationship. The reason for this second person is that the employee will act his best self in front of someone he feels likes or respects him. Who should not be present? Armed security guards, local police, or Big Ed from the loading dock should not be part of the termination meeting. Though some employers believe that this presence puts them in a position of strength, it does exactly the opposite. It sets all your vulnerabilities on the table for the potentially dangerous employee to exploit. No equal co-worker or direct supervisor should be present either. They increase the likelihood of embarrassment, along with the likelihood of getting into a heated discussion about the past. The manager running the termination meeting shows his strength by not appearing to need any reinforcements. Many employers view firing as something done from a position of power, but it's not so. There was a day when Richard Farley was the most powerful man at ESL. There was a day when David Burke was the most powerful man at US Air. They had anger and righteous indignation, and, as Emerson said, a good indignation brings out all one's powers. Righteous indignation can be the engine for behaviors that an employee might never have even considered before. Remember, this man is not a monster. He is someone they hired who might have worked at a company for years. But now he is in shock. This firing has shaken his world. Either he didn't expect it, or it confirms his view of the world because he always expected it. In any case, it's an unwelcome and belittling change that is being forced on him. He could stand not being liked in the company, but being ignored, rejected, erased, that is quite a different matter. The firing is much bigger to him because of what he links to it: loss of status, loss of income, loss of security, loss of purpose, loss of identity, and above all, loss in a fight. His opponents have won, and he has lost. Because of all of this, an important power shift takes place at the instant of firing. Everything changes as a wide range of options and alternatives opens up to the fired employee that he could never have applied when he was trying to keep his job. The primary leverage of employers is the ability to fire. But once they do it, once the power is exercised, their one shot has been fired and the gun is empty. After that, the power is in the hands of the employee. Many companies have learned that the cost of underestimating this power is far greater than the cost of respecting it. Given the industriousness of lawyers and the prevalence of wrongful termination suits, some companies have been more concerned about litigation than hazard. When a fired employee threatens a lawsuit, he may get more attention than for other threats. But this is ironic, because in the context of the kind of employee we're discussing here, the threatening of a lawsuit is actually good news. As long as he is focused on a lawsuit, he sees alternatives to violence. The problem with lawsuits comes not when they start, but when they end. We know that eventually, particularly when claims are unreasonable or outrageous, the employee will lose the legal battle. Then the company may have to face that person's anger again. When employers avoid provoking or engaging a fired employee, however, time itself will heal most wounds, hopefully including those to his dignity and identity. What is the best way to respond to threats in a termination meeting? In Chapter 7, I provided many concepts about threats that apply to this question. Remember that the value of threats is determined by our reaction. Accordingly, if an employee makes threats when he's fired, the best theme for the reaction is, "I understand you are upset, but the things you are talking about are not your style. I know you're far too reasonable and have too good a future to even consider such things." This reaction is not intended to convince the threatener that he isn't angry, but rather to convince him that you are not afraid. It's also important to let the threatener know that he has not embarked on a course from which he cannot retreat. A good theme is, "We all say things when we react emotionally. I've done it myself. Let's just forget it. I know you'll feel different tomorrow." Even in the cases in which the threats are determined to be serious and thus call for interventions or extensive preparations, we advise clients never to show the threatener a high appraisal of his words and never to show fear. This doesn't mean they shouldn't take precautions. In fact, when clients are firing difficult employees, we guide them through many precautions, including monitoring the meeting by video from nearby rooms, having security intervention teams at the ready, installation of emergency call buttons, and improved access control procedures after the firing. All termination meetings, whether they go well or poorly, provide valuable insights into how the fired employee is going to behave later. As important, this meeting also shows the fired employee how management will react to his behavior. Immediately after a termination meeting, the person who conducted the firing should make a report of the attitude, behavior, responses, and statements of the fired employee. The information can be assessed by professionals whose opinions can help inform decisions about security and other relevant matters. Among the issues to be decided after a difficult termination is whether anyone needs to be notified about possible risk. The failure to warn people who might be the targets of violence can be negligent, as can be the failure to take back access credentials, monitor an angry employee's departure from the building, notify security personnel and receptionist, or take any other steps appropriate when someone is believed to be dangerous to others. The worst possible reaction to a threat is a counter-threat. When threats work for the employee, it's because, having little to lose, he might actually do a reckless thing, and management knows that. Conversely, the employee intuitively knows that management will not do a reckless thing. Also, counter-threats make things worse. Think of violence as interactional. The way you respond to a threat might up the ante and turn this situation into a contest of threats, escalations, and counter-threats. It's a contest employers rarely win, for they have far more at risk than the terminated employee and far more ways to lose. Examples of counter-threats include management saying, "Oh, yeah? Well, I'll have the cops on you the minute you try it." Counter-threats engage the threatener and put you on his playing field. You want exactly the opposite. which is to disengage and to play by your rules. Having said this, I should add that there is also a time to let go of rules altogether. My office consulted on a case in which our client, a mid-sized city, put rules above safety. An employee who was retiring on a mental disability rejected the $11,000 the city offered because it didn't include a $400 reimbursement he felt entitled to. The rules prohibited reimbursement for expenditures that were not approved ahead of time, so the city refused to pay it. One afternoon, the ex-employee arrived without an appointment and demanded to see the administrator who had made that decision. The two argued, but the administrator held firm to the rules. The employee stood up and said, "Let me see if I can put this another way." He then placed two .38 caliber bullets on the administrator's desk and left. Our office was asked to assess the situation. We learned that this employee had shown a handgun to his therapist and commented on the principle of the financial dispute. Right is right, and right always wins. In our report, we suggested that the city pay the $400, since winning that point had become a matter of pride and identity to the former employee. Acceding to people's demands isn't always possible or practical. But in this case, the entire consequence was the $400. By the city's reaction to our suggestion, you would think we had asked them to give up their firstborn sons. The administrator told me, "We have rules, and if we buckle under to everybody who makes a demand, those rules will be meaningless." He could have benefited from the wisdom of Oliver Wendell Holmes. The young man knows the rules, but the old man knows the exceptions. Like the threatener, this administrator was committed to the principle of the matter. In such cases, we say both parties are in the ring, meaning they are willing or even anxious to stay in the fight. I said, "We aren't suggesting that you give $400 to everyone who asks for it, but rather that you give $400 just to the desperate, emotionally disturbed ex-employees who, after showing a gun to their therapists, plop bullets down on your desk to make a point. I don't expect the city will be paying out on that policy too often." But the administrator was clinging to some higher ideal than just the money. In fact, he was spending more than $400 just arguing his opinion with me. After he finished his second, more spirited lecture on the sanctity of rules, I wanted to bring us back to the high-stakes context. "I have a suggestion. Since rules are so powerful, let's make a new rule that says employees cannot shoot administrators. Won't that solve the problem?" He actually appeared to be thinking over my rhetorical suggestion when I asked, "Which rule would you rather see broken?" Wars have been fought over easier issues, but the administrator finally agreed to the $400 payment. The ex-employee moved to Arizona, and the city survived its brief affair with flexibility. Such resolutions may seem obvious, but when participants are in the ring, it's hard for them to see past their fists. Not a week passes without an organization seeking my advice on an employee who scares his co-workers. Reviewing so many situations with near identical features and seeing how they harm productivity, cause anxiety, and put people at risk, I've come to respect the value of avoidance and prevention. The corporations and agencies that have dedicated the time and resources to addressing these hazards before they occur have, in effect, elected to learn lessons secondhand rather than have their employees learn them firsthand. No matter how well managers manage, however, there may still be some violence in the workplace that doesn't reveal itself early. That's because it starts closer to home. What is it that employers who have had the worst outcomes did or failed to do? Of course, hiring is where it starts. The hiring officer has made a prediction that the candidate will meet the needs of the company and will be a well-adjusted, capable, and productive employee. We know predictions are better with more information. So investigating candidates' backgrounds is key. I don't mean that background checks can be expected to reliably screen out employees who will later act violently, because violence is a process that evolves over time. It's not a condition or a state. But effective background checks do give an employer the opportunity to learn important information about a candidate the easy way. I testified in a case involving a security firm called MacGuard, which employed a man named Rodney Garmanian. They gave him the uniform he used to lure an 18-year-old girl named Teek Dyer into his car. They gave him the car he used to drive her away. They gave him the keys to the locked building where he took her, the handcuffs he used to restrain her, the billy club he struck her with, and the gun he murdered her with. MacGuard had failed to conduct any pre-employment background check or even to review Garmanian's application. Had they taken those few minutes, they'd have learned that he failed to fill out most of the form, and what he did fill out was not favorable. He had listed his term in the military as being 3 months. That kind of thing is an obvious area for inquiry. Why were you in the military for only 3 months, Mr. Garmanian? Most people are in the military longer. He had listed his reason for leaving on two of the former jobs as fired. Yet, MacGuard didn't ask him anything about that. Perhaps the most chilling thing about this case is what I learned simply by calling two of his former employers. The first told me, "Oh, yes, I remember Rodney Garmanian. He once tried to have sex with a girl on the second floor when the building was closed." The second person said, "Oh, yes, I remember Rodney Garmanian. He drew sexually solicitous drawings and put them in the ladies' room." The murder Garmanian ultimately committed occurred in the ladies' room on the second floor of a closed building. For 25 cents, I had learned information that, had Garmanian's employers bothered to get it, could have saved Teek Dyer's life. Checking references and checking with former employers is an absolutely critical duty of every employer. Another case I testified in involved an employee who intentionally drove his truck at high speed through a line of picketers. Several people were injured, and one was brain damaged. Here again, there was an ineffective pre-employment inquiry. References were not called. Information offered on the application was not confirmed. In fact, just on the face of it, the application demonstrated a lack of full disclosure and a lack of honesty. For example, telephone numbers listed under references also appeared under relatives. And telephone numbers that, when dialed, went to people's homes were offered as being companies. Checking such things can tell you without much effort that the applicant is not honest. At a minimum, it tells you that there are some additional issues to be explored with him. Chapter 10. Intimate Enemies. You never do anything about him. You talk to him, and then you leave. Nicole Brown Simpson to police. I don't see how anyone could have had doubts after hearing the eloquent prosecutor describe the case. We all know the story. The murdered woman had reportedly suffered violence at the hands of the defendant for a long time, virtually since the start of their relationship. A few times she had called the police, and once she even brought battery charges against him. He was acquitted, but the violence continued. The day of the murder, she hadn't invited him to come along to a social event, and not long after 10 p.m., she was stabbed to death. The defendant told a friend that he'd had a dream in which he killed her, but later his lawyer said she was probably murdered by drug dealers. These facts became famous during the O.J. Simpson case, but the story I just told occurred thousands of miles from Brentwood when Nicole Brown Simpson still had 6 months left to live. The murdered woman in this case was named Meredith Coppola. If I told of all the other women killed in America this year by a husband or boyfriend, the book you are holding would be 4,000 pages long, and the stories would be stunningly similar. Only the names and a few details would change. I worked with the prosecution on the stalking aspects of the Simpson criminal trial, and later on the civil suit brought by the Goldman family. But I don't discuss the case here as an advocate. In one sense, it's nothing more than an example of this common crime. In another sense, however, it is much, much more. For American children who were under 10 in 1997, this one case dominated the news for at least 30% of their lives. It was all that was on daytime TV, all they saw on tabloid covers at their eye level at the supermarket, and all that the adults seemed to be discussing at the dinner table. It is, ultimately, an American myth about daddy killing mommy and getting away with it. Whatever your opinion of the case, that myth is part of its legacy. So are the many myths that were widely promoted by the scheme team, Simpson's criminal defense lawyers. They told us, just because a man beats his wife doesn't mean he killed her, and that's true. But what's that got to do with O.J. Simpson, who beat his wife, broke into her home, threatened her, at least once with a gun, terrorized her, and stalked her? That behavior puts him very near the center of the predictive circle for wife murder. The scheme team's observation is a little like saying, just because someone buys dough doesn't mean he's going to make pizza. And that's true. But if he buys dough, spreads it around on the tiny tray, adds tomato sauce, adds cheese, and puts it in the oven, then, even if Simpson lawyer Alan Dershowitz tells you differently, you can be comfortable predicting that pizza is being made. Why do I call the Simpson lawyers the scheme team? Because it reminds me that wife murderers and their lawyers frequently scheme to design defenses for an indefensible crime. Every murder discussed in this chapter, except those in which the perpetrators committed suicide after killing their spouses, was followed by some creative legal excuse-making. What was clear in the Simpson case is that while Ron Goldman may have been in the wrong place at the wrong time, Nicole had been in the wrong place for a long time. As Prosecutor Scott Gordon, now the chairman of L.A.'s forward-thinking domestic violence council, said, Simpson was killing Nicole for years. She finally died on June 12th. This concept of a long, slow crime is what I want to focus on as we discuss predicting and preventing these tragedies. Despite the misinformation offered to the American public by paid advocates in service of just one man, there are many reliable pre-incident indicators associated with spousal violence and murder. They won't all be present in every case, but if a situation has several of these signals, there is reason for concern. 1. The woman has intuitive feelings that she is at risk. 2. At the inception of the relationship, the man accelerated the pace, prematurely placing on the agenda such things as commitment, living together, and marriage. 3. He resolves conflict with intimidation, bullying, and violence. 4. He is verbally abusive. 5. He uses threats and intimidation as instruments of control or abuse. This includes threats to harm physically, to defame, to embarrass, to restrict freedom, to disclose secrets, to cut off support, to abandon, and to commit suicide. 6. He breaks or strikes things in anger. He uses symbolic violence, tearing a wedding photo, marring a face in a photo, etc. 7. He has battered in prior relationships. 8. He uses alcohol or drugs with adverse effects. Memory loss, hostility, cruelty. 9. He cites alcohol or drugs as an excuse or explanation for hostile or violent conduct. That was the booze talk and not me. I got so drunk I was crazy. 10. His history includes police encounters for behavioral offenses, threats, stalking, assault, battery. 11. There has been more than one incident of violent behavior, including vandalism, breaking things, throwing things. 12. He uses money to control the activities, purchases, and behavior of his wife, partner. 13. He becomes jealous of anyone or anything that takes her time away from the relationship. He keeps her on a tight leash, requires her to account for her time. 14. He refuses to accept rejection. 15. He expects the relationship to go on forever, perhaps using phrases like, together for life, always, no matter what. 16. He projects extreme emotions onto others, hate, love, jealousy, commitment, even when there is no evidence that would lead a reasonable person to perceive them. 17. He minimizes incidents of abuse. 18. He spends a disproportionate amount of time talking about his wife, partner, and derives much of his identity from being her husband, lover, etc. 19. He tries to enlist his wife's friends or relatives in a campaign to keep or recover the relationship. 20. He has inappropriately surveilled or followed his wife, partner. 21. He believes others are out to get him. He believes that those around his wife, partner, dislike him and encourage her to leave. 22. He resists change and is described as inflexible, unwilling to compromise. 23. He identifies with or compares himself to violent people in films, news stories, fiction, or history. He characterizes the violence of others as justified. 24. He suffers mood swings or is sullen, angry, or depressed. 25. He consistently blames others for problems of his own making. He refuses to take responsibility for the results of his actions. 26. He refers to weapons as instruments of power, control, or revenge. 27. Weapons are a substantial part of his persona. He has a gun, or he talks about, jokes about, reads about, or collects weapons. 28. He uses male privilege as a justification for his conduct, treats her like a servant, makes all the big decisions, acts like the master of the house. 29. He experienced or witnessed violence as a child. 30. His wife partner fears he will injure or kill her. She has discussed this with others or has made plans to be carried out in the event of her death, e.g., designating someone to care for children. With this list and all you know about intuition and prediction, you can now help prevent America's most predictable murders. Literally. Refer the woman to a battered women's shelter, if for nothing else than to speak to someone who knows about what she is facing in her life and in herself. Refer the man to a battered women's shelter. They will be able to suggest programs for him. When there is violence, report it to the police. This list reminds us that before our next breakfast, another 12 women will be killed. Mothers, sisters, daughters. In almost every case, the violence that preceded the final violence was a secret kept by several people. This list can say to women who are in that situation that they must get out. It can say to police officers who might not arrest that they must arrest. To doctors who might not notify that they must notify. It can say to prosecutors that they must file charges. It can say to neighbors who might ignore violence that they must not. It can also speak to men who might recognize themselves, and that is meaningful. After Christopher Darden's closing argument in the Simpson trial, co-prosecutor Scott Gordon and I joined him in his office. We read faxes from around the country sent by victims of domestic violence. But we were equally moved by messages from abusive men, one of which read, "You may have just saved my wife's life, for as I listened to you describing Simpson's abuse, I recognized myself." Unlike some murders, spousal homicide is a crime that can strike with conscience. Before any discussion on how a woman can get out of an unwanted relationship, we must first recognize that many women choose not to get out. Right now, as you are reading these words, at least one woman in America is being beaten by her husband. And now, another. For it happens once every few seconds. So while it's old news that many men are violent, We must also accept that a nearly equal number of women choose to stay with him. This means that many accurate predictions of danger are being ignored. Why? I can share part of the answer from my personal experience as a boy. I vividly recall the night when my sister and I ran out the door at 2 a.m. after hours of violence, afraid to go back home. We called the police from a payphone and reported two kids loitering so that we'd get picked up and taken to jail where we'd be safe. That experience and the years that led up to it helped me to understand that many women stay for the same reason I stayed. Until that night, no other possibility ever occurred to me. Before that night, you could no more have got me to voluntarily leave my family than I could get you to leave yours right now. Like the battered child, the battered woman gets a powerful feeling of overwhelming relief when an incident ends. She becomes addicted to that feeling. The abuser is the only person who can deliver moments of peace by being his better self for a while. Thus, the abuser holds the key to the abused person's feeling of well-being. The abuser delivers the high highs that bookend the low lows, and the worse the bad times get, the better the good times are in contrast. All of this is in addition to the fact that a battered woman is shell-shocked enough to believe that each horrible incident may be the last. Understanding how people evaluate personal risk has helped me better understand why so many women in danger stay there. As I learned from my experiences with violence as a child, many of these women have been beaten so much that their fear mechanism is dulled to the point that they take in stride risks that others would consider extraordinary. The relationship between violence and death is no longer apparent to them. One woman, who'd been at a shelter and then returned to her abuser, gives us a good example. She called the shelter late one night to ask if she could come back. As always, the first question the counselor asked was, "Are you in danger now?" The woman said no. Later in the call, the woman added, almost as an aside, that her husband was outside the room with a gun. Hadn't she just a moment earlier said she wasn't in danger? To her, if he was in the same room with the gun, or the gun was being held to her head, then she would be in danger. How could someone feel that being beaten does not justify leaving? Being struck and forced not to resist is a particularly damaging form of abuse because it trains out of the victim the instinctive reaction to protect the self. To override that most natural and central instinct, a person must come to believe that he or she is not worth protecting. Being beaten by a loved one sets up a conflict between two instincts that should never compete: the instinct to stay in a secure environment, the family, and the instinct to flee a dangerous environment. As if on a seesaw, the instinct to stay prevails in the absence of concrete options on the other side. Getting that lopsided seesaw off the ground takes more energy than many victims have. No amount of logic can usually move a battered woman, so persuasion requires emotional leverage, not statistics or moral arguments. In many efforts to convince women to leave violent relationships, I have seen their fear and resistance firsthand. I recall a long talk with Janine, a 33-year-old mother of two who showed me photos the police had taken of her injuries after one of the frequent beatings she received. She was eager to tell me about her husband's abuse, but just as eager to make excuses for him. Though the most recent beatings had left her with three broken ribs, she was going back to him again. I asked her what she would do if her teenage daughter was beaten up by a boyfriend. "Well, I'd probably kill the guy. But one thing's for sure, I'd tell her she could never see him again." "What is the difference between you and your daughter?" I asked. Janine, who had a fast explanation for every aspect of her husband's behavior, had no answer for her own, so I offered her one. "The difference is that your daughter has you, and you don't have you. If you don't get out soon, your daughter won't have you either." This was resonant to Janine because of its truth. She really didn't have a part of herself, the self-protective part. She had come out of her own childhood with it already shaken, and her husband had beaten it out completely. She did, however, retain the instinct to protect her children, and it was for them that she was finally able to leave. Though leaving is not an option that seems available to many battered women, I believe that the first time a woman is hit, she is a victim, and the second time, she is a volunteer. Invariably, after a television interview or speech in which I say this, I hear from people who feel I don't understand the dynamic of battery, that I don't understand the syndrome. In fact, I have a deep and personal understanding of the syndrome. But I never pass up an opportunity to make clear that staying is a choice. Of those who argue that it isn't, I ask, is it a choice when a woman finally does leave? Or is there some syndrome to explain leaving as if it too is involuntary? I believe it is critical for a woman to view staying as a choice, for only then can leaving be viewed as a choice and an option. Also, if we dismiss the woman's participation as being beyond choice, then what about the man? Couldn't we point to his childhood, his insecurities, his shaky identity, his addiction to control, and say that his behavior too is determined by a syndrome, and is thus beyond his choice? Every human behavior can be explained by what precedes it. But that does not excuse it, and we must hold abusive men accountable. Whoever we may blame, there is some responsibility on both sides of the gender line, particularly if there are children involved. Both parents who participate are hurting their children terribly, the man more than the woman, but both parents. Children learn most from modeling, and as a mother accepts the blows, so likely will her daughter. As a father delivers the blows, so likely will his son. Though I know that dedicated, constructive people want to educate the public as to why so many women stay, I want to focus on how so many women leave. Helen Keller, a woman in another type of trap, said, "Although the world is full of suffering, it is also full of the overcoming of it." Many batterers control the money, allowing little access to bank accounts or even financial information. Some control the schedule, the car keys, the major purchases, the choice in clothes, the choice in friends. The batterer may be a benevolent control freak at the start of an intimate relationship, but he becomes a malevolent control freak later. And there's another wrinkle. He gives punishment and reward unpredictably, so that any day now, any moment now, he'll be his great old self, his honeymoon self. And this provides an ingredient that is essential to keeping the woman from leaving. Hope. Does he do all this with evil design? No. It's part of his concept of how to retain love. Children who do not learn to expect and accept love in natural ways become adults who find other ways to get it. Controlling may work for a while, even a long while, but then it begins not to work. And so he escalates. He will do anything to stay in control, but his wife is changing, and that causes him to suffer. In fact, the Buddhist definition of human suffering applies perfectly. Clinging to that which changes. When men in these situations don't find out what is going on inside them, when they don't get counseling or therapy, it's a choice to continue using violence. Such men are taking the risk that violence will escalate to homicide, for, as Carl Jung said, when an inner situation is not made conscious, it appears outside as fate. Working closely with a domestic violence council, I've learned that for every battered woman who makes the choice to leave, we as a society must provide a place for her to go. In Los Angeles County, where 11 million people live, there are only 420 battered women's shelter beds. On any given night, 75% of those beds are occupied by children. In Los Angeles, we have a hotline that automatically connects callers to the nearest shelter. Through that number, established by Los Angeles District Attorney Gil Garcetti, battered women are taught how to get out safely. They learn to make duplicates of car keys and identification papers, how to hide these items from their husbands, how to choose the best time to run, and how not to be tracked when they escape into the modern-day underground railroad that shelters have become. I believe so strongly in the value of this hotline that my company funds it. I mention it here because every city in America needs such a number and needs to get it prominently displayed in phone booths, phone books, gas stations, schools, and hospital emergency rooms. An 800 number like ours, answered by people who have been there and understand the dilemma, is often more likely to be used than the alternative number, which I also recommend, 911. The reason for some women's reluctance to call the police is eloquently expressed by the case of Nicole Brown Simpson. In one episode, not revealed during the criminal trial, Simpson pushed Nicole out of a moving car in a parking lot. A police officer who happened on the scene told Simpson, "Take your wife home." In another incident, well after they were divorced, Simpson broke down the door into Nicole's home. A responding officer told Nicole his conclusion about what had happened. "No blows were thrown. He didn't throw anything at you. We don't have anything other than a verbal altercation." Nicole responded correctly. "Breaking and entering, I'd call it." "Well," the officer countered, "it's a little different when the two of you have a relationship. It's not like he's a burglar." "Absolutely wrong, officer. It's very much like he's a burglar, and it was breaking and entering and trespassing." After assuring O.J. Simpson that they'd keep the incident as quiet as legally possible, the officers left. By the way, the LAPD and the L.A. Sheriff's Department are now leading the nation in new ways to manage domestic violence cases. Earlier, I noted that America has tens of thousands of suicide prevention centers, but no homicide prevention centers. Battered women's shelters are the closest thing we have to homicide prevention centers. There are women and children in your community whose lives are in danger, who need to know how to get out, and who need a place to escape too. Los Angeles, the home city of the nation's most notorious wife abuser, is, I'm proud to say, also the city with an escape plan for battered families that other cities can use as a model.
Wow. Context of white supremacy, not all the way healthy, but much better than last week. Gus T. Renegade, so we are still in chapter 10. We have a ways to go before we conclude this chapter. We are still way more than halfway done with the book, closing on the end. That last sentence, Los Angeles, the home city of the nation's most notorious wife abuser. Really? System of racism, white supremacy, the juice. This book came out before the ESPN 8-hour documentary. It came out before the Fox docuseries. 1997, Gavin DeBecker, The Gift of Fear. O.J. Simpson aside, I do think there's constructive information in the book. I think we said that a few times, some of the folks who dialed in to share. Man, the line, I'm going to get to the callers and give out the number. The line where he said, the first time a woman is hit, she is a victim. And the second time, she is a volunteer. Now, in the book, he has that in boldface print and in italics. I immediately, Neely Fuller Jr. First time, last time, that's what he says. That should be the counter-racist code for males and females. I've heard him say it repeatedly. First time, last time, and to make that explicit, abundantly clear at the beginning of the arrangement. Hey, we'll probably have some conflicts. I'll get on your nerves, vice versa. We're victims. Nothing physical. Any touching, ever for any reason. First time, last time. That's the way he articulates it. That reminds me a lot. Incidentally, there was one little segment, the chapter 9 in the audiobook is different than the text chapter 9. It confused me enough that I rewound the audio briefly, and it's just written different. I thought that maybe my finger slipped and maybe I fast forwarded or rewound or something of that nature, but it appears the I can't even say that that's a surprise because there were subtle differences, but it seems like there's a significant difference to the way that chapter 9 concludes for the audiobook. But be that as it may, chapter 10 should be all caught up. The number is 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. If we have any listeners, if you have been in the abusive arrangement and you feel comfortable, safe, all right, discussing what happened, dial in and let us know if what we heard in this section of the book, if it seems reasonable, if it would have helped, like having some of the information in the book, if it would have helped you in your arrangement, helped you solve some problems. Let us know. If you don't think it would have been helpful or logical, you can share that as well. But again, only if you feel comfortable sharing. Again, I know that might not necessarily be something that is the most pleasant thing to have to recall and then share publicly. Also wanted to ask as well, or I'll get my questions in later. Star 61, if folks have comments, questions they would like to share, lines should be open. Let's see. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
My name is Stuart, and I'm from Nebraska. And this book, I can't remember the author's name. I just got Gavin something. He's given a good presentation on the mindset of white supremacy throughout the audio books that you've been playing, and that I've listened to as far as the playback. But today, you know, I came in on like the last 15 minutes of this section that you was playing, and a few things I wrote down. One of them was that, you know, he's giving the impression like an abuser in a sense is separate from the society as a whole, in the sense that, you know, considering white supremacy is the major abuser in this society, you know, even definitely black people, but also in the systems that it creates that actually, you know, gives birth to a lot of behaviors that he's speaking of as far as abuse. And but in his mind, you know, those techniques and tactics used of white supremacy are not abuse. That's why he keeps bringing up, in a sense, you know, black names to put images in people's minds, you know, when they read this book, of what to fear, in a sense. So, you know, he's probably just doing a dang good job of, you know, informing white people on how to practice white supremacy. Especially when he spoke of, you know, how the person that's being battered keeps coming back. You know, you can take those kind of ideas and images that he's putting forth in this book and apply them to how black people are treated up under white supremacy. That a lot of things really do become clear. You know, they really do become clear. You start to think, like, as a black person, you know, why do I keep going back to being abused by these white supremacists? You know, in most cases, you know, it's the black people that You know, I got to keep my economics up. You know, I got to keep things going. You know, and you know, dealing with that every day causes a lot of pain. You know, and like you always say, you know, they can find resources in the practice of white supremacy, but they can't find resources, you know, to, you know, help the victims of white supremacy. In most instances. When you spoke of like the women leaving abuse and, you know, asking the lady, you know, why do you keep going back? And she's, in a sense, lost a piece of herself. You can kind of also put that in a sense as far as black people, you know, we lost our piece of ourselves as far as our history and culture. You know, also, a lot of times, you know, you make it seem like, you know, people who are abused, you know, don't necessarily grow up to be abusers. But in a sense, a lot of people who do abuse, you know, they were abused themselves, as is commonly known. So even the person that goes on later on and gets into abusive relationships, to them, it might be just normal. Same as with black people, you know, getting abused by white supremacy as, you know, as unnatural and unnormal as it is, you know, it seems like it's normal. You know, it's something you got to deal with every day. And, you know, we got to kind of get away from that. But, and O.J. Simpson, they just can't get enough of him, poor guy. They got to, you know, like you said, you know, that last comment, yeah, that was, O.J., the most notorious abuser. I'd say Rockefeller. Got to say Warburg. I can say what's that cat? Killed all those folks in Africa. I can't think of his name right now. Maybe somebody did it. But that's all I have to say right now.
Much obliged, caller in Nebraska. Thank you for your commentary, sir. For people who read this book before the cows got to it in the book club, people who read this book, what did you all make of his comments on O.J. Simpson and Al Sharpton? Like I said, I think the book has valuable information in a variety of different points. We've talked about domestic abuse on this program before, talked about it in the Man Nut, extremely important subject matter. If folks have, as I said, experience or commentary on that, let's hear it. But what did people who read this book beforehand, how did they process his thoughts on OJ and Mr. Sharpton? Just a thought. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have comments, proceed.
Hi, Senator.
Yes, ma'am. Greetings, Draptomania.
Greetings, Seth, and callers and listeners. I wanted to answer your question regarding what did I think when I read this book. Prior to it, from the two cows, when he mentioned audition Simpson and Sharpton, I really don't think that I analyzed it to this degree. I was just becoming more, you know, informed about message and my supremacy as a result of pushing the TV show. And although I did grow up in you know, the movement and things like that, and you know, so-called conscious, it just still shows, you know, goes to show how much I still did not, under the guise of, you know, being, you know, awoke or conscious and growing up in the under those types of influences, how unaware I still was. So I didn't even analyze it the way that you're doing it now, and I didn't see it from that view. I just didn't really, I don't think I'd even look at it that deep as we're doing right now. So that's why I'm grateful that we have this platform, because, it, like I said, it just goes to show you, even though you can't be, you know, have been around and grown up and with certain influences, how much you still can be confused, although you have all this knowledge and all this information. It does not mean that you are not confused about the system. And your show is giving me more of a clearer view on how the system of white supremacy works. And by analyzing it with this group, although I read it before, I think this is very, it's a great platform to go over it again. Because to see how much I didn't understand and how much I didn't know. So, I'm quite sure I might have, I don't even remember, Paul, what my reaction was, but I don't think it was as, I can't even think of the word, aware as, going through it through this platform. And that was my feedback in regards to your questions, and I'll share later on if I have opportunity. Thanks for listening.
Yes, I'm much obliged. Draftomania, we're all still learning. Other folks who dialed in, if you have comments, questions, proceed.
Yes, may I be heard?
Greetings, Mr. Demery Four.
Yes, greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers and listeners. I want to address your question, but a little later when I get to the O.J. Simpson part. I want to start out with the, I guess you could consider it, workplace, actually part of, your program, workplace racism. When they're talking about firing employees, and he was talking about terminating, well, the list of strategies that he gives that they can be applicable to terminating other emotionally invested relationships, such as involving unwanted suitors, business partners, and former spouses. One thing I didn't agree with him when it comes to the firing is, if you're a manager and let's say you're responsible for hiring and firing, if you hired this person, you should be a responsible enough person to let him go. And you should do it properly, along with the counseling and letting him know what areas he needs work in and a time to bring up his work progress. And all, if he don't, he don't meet these goals, it's clearly laid out before him. Then he can better see it. But you trying to get a higher level manager to come down and fire somebody for you, I don't think that goes over too good in many companies. And that part about delivering bad news in a roundabout way, if an employee or an employer has done his work properly, the actual firing, it's just another step in the process, and then the person being let go will probably be closer to understanding why he didn't meet up. And you can do all these things right: the time, the office setting, choosing your cast, and all that. If you are a certain type employee, it's very unlikely that you will resort to violent means. But see, some of these employers make sure that when they fire you, you don't meet the qualifications for unemployment insurance, or you will never be able to seek employment in this type of occupation again. You know, those are the things that a fired employee feels that he can't live with. I have a beef, I have a problem with him saying that Richard Farley was the most powerful man at ESL and that David Burke was the most powerful man at U.S. Air. And David Burke was a non-white black person. At the time that he shot Bob, I believe was his name, on the airplane, he may have been, with the gun in his hand, the most powerful man on that aircraft. But this reading would lead you to believe that he was a very powerful man throughout U.S. Air. And if you read a little background on that, he actually shot his boss on the aircraft and killed both the pilots. And so they descended at a rate so great it almost broke the sound barrier. So then he starts talking about this man is not a monster. Or, you know, at what point does a person lose their humanity? Or what do you have to do to them? You know, nothing is said about that. For somebody to buy a one-way ticket and get on and make sure your life ends, along with his and everybody else, something really traumatic, I think, happened way before that. I think that they had accused Mr. Burke of smuggling drugs and all kind of things. But Richard Farley was a mistake of the company because they had several chances to stop. They knew about him, and they gave wrong advice and almost got the lady killed, but several people were killed. And, you know, all these examples that he gives are men abusing women. And I'm not trying to minimize any of that. That's a terrible thing. But I was just wondering, there are also a history of female masked shooters. One I know come to my mind, Amy Bishop, university professor at Alabama, opened fire in a facility meeting with a 9mm, killing three members and injuring three others. And a couple other incidents here, you know, Brenda Spencer, white female killed two at the elementary school. She lived across the street. She said the reason why she killed those people because she didn't like Mondays. And Mondays, that would lighten, aliven things up a little bit, that shooting that she did. That was Brenda Spencer. And, you know, recently, Lorraine Wright's ex-wife, the NBA basketball player whose wife murdered him, you know, collected the life insurance company, got away for several years. She was just recently convicted. Jennifer San Marcos shooting six people in a post office 2006. You know, I'm just saying, I think that if this behavior has pre-indicators to it, it should be applicable either sex, and we should be able to use it as victims in relationship to the system of white supremacy. Now I'll end with what I think about his referring to Reverend Sharpton and O.J. Simpson. When I first read about O.J. Simpson, you know, I don't know about anybody else, but O.J. Simpson was acquitted. And the last time I checked, acquittal is a judgment that a person is not guilty of the crime which the person has been charged. But if you read this book, if you didn't know, if you wasn't there, you don't know anything about O.J., you would think it's slammed up. O.J. did it, and his scheme team, what he called it, covered up for him. But, you know, I don't see the same righteous indignation when it comes to, you know, even the other sex or when black people are being mistreated in the system of white supremacy. I'll mute my line at Gus. Thanks for taking the call. I think I answered your question.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery, for thank you for citing some examples of female perpetrators. Important because he, you know, takes a very biased, explicitly biased stance in his presentation of the book. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if we have missed you thus far, *61. If you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Emmy. Good to hear from you.
Greetings, everyone. To answer your question about, okay, first, actually, even though I was someone that said, yeah, I like this book, I want to read it, I was actually in the beginning of reading it. So I actually have never, like, read the book in its entirety, and then I'm rereading it now. I'm actually reading it pretty much the first time with everyone else, even if I'm not on the calls. So, and my focus, I have to be transparent here, has not necessarily been using it as a critique of the system of racism and white supremacy. I have really been studying it from the perspective of how to avoid certain encounters, even with non-white people. And so I guess I would have to say that I really have not paid, I wasn't paying that much attention to the comments about Al Sharpton or O.J. Simpson. So I'm very grateful that you are. Okay, so when I first expressed my interest in this book, I was strolling in, something in me said, I want a good book. Then I went to the bookstore and I was strolling through the whole self-help, psychology, like all that aisle. And then it was something about the title that made me grab it. And then a Yoruba woman at the register confirmed that it was a good book. And I read a little bit of it before I purchased it, like in the very beginning. And I kind of appreciated his attention to detail. I know that can be very verbose for some people, but it was very conversational, so I decided to purchase the book. So that's what had me go for the book. I have come to the conclusion that I've experienced abuse my entire life. Now, he asserts that physical abuse is the worst of all the types of abuses. I'm not so sure that that's true, even in my own research to try to understand my own situation. That psychological abuse sometimes has much deeper lingering legacies for the person and even in future generations, because, you know, when someone hits you, at a point, yes, you will stay, you might stay and all that kind of stuff, but there's a point where the mind can say, I'm being hit, whereas someone manipulating you, controlling you, or neglecting you, we don't necessarily think of these as forms of abuse. So we haven't been trained to think of them that way, so we don't relate to them that way, and we can easily deny that that is, in fact, what is occurring. And so, you know, the brain might say, well, maybe it's me. And so then we have all of these other personality like deficits, really, that kind of occur because of that. I have experienced it my entire life. And I reached a point in my own very close family relationships. And then because, and this is me processing through this, so bear with me in my attempt to try to understand why I continue to attract certain relationships. That's what led me to this, because I felt that they were escalating. Like, I was attracting pretty much the same person, but each time would be like a little bit more aggressive. Not enough to whip me, but like something was a little bit more off. And I experienced a lot of what he's talking about in terms of the list. So give me a second while I pull the list up. But for like the intuitive thing, it was his focus on intuition. That's something I'm also researching, but that's not like some superfluous metaphysical spiritual realm kind of conversation, but at an actual function of our brain, which is something that calls to me because I like science and I like logic. I'm attracted to it. And so knowing that, you know, maybe I'm picking up on things, that my brain is picking up on things in a way that my conscious brain cannot necessarily, like the unconscious brain is faster than my conscious brain, was something that made a lot of sense to me, but I could override it with my conscious brain. Like, no, just like the woman, I feel like I could have been the woman in the staircase so many times where, you know what I'm saying? So anyway, like throughout the list, there's a bunch of things: control, verbally abusive, intimidation. And some of these words are so charged that we don't understand the nuance of the word. Intimidation is not all the time just like someone in your face, but there's so many forms of control and intimidation and ways of being bullied. He strikes things in anger. I've been there. Alcohol and drugs, been there. Memory loss is the use of manipulating and controlling me. I've been there. History with police, been there. Money, been there. Or like number 12, using money, been there. 13, been there. 14, refuses rejection. Like even things like saying, I'll kill myself if you leave, I've been there. And trying to enlist friends and family to make me stay, I've been there. But I haven't only been there in people that I've dated. I've been there with those that are even most closest to me that are I'm supposed to be able to trust and love. So minimizes abuse, been there. The weapons things, maybe not as much, but resisting to change, I've been there. Mood swings, like all of that stuff. So that's very close to me. And I'm at a point now where I refuse to continue to do the same thing. And so I'm willing to enlist whatever resources are available to me so that I do not continue to make the same choices, because it hurts a lot and it's damaging. And over the years, as you get older, I think it can accrue and just get harder to process each time. And I refuse to be broken, and I think the question was, could I have benefited from it before? Absolutely. And like I said, his focus is really like on the violence, but when he says violence, my brain says control and manipulation, which I experience as violence as well. So my brain doesn't think violence like, oh, someone just has to beat me in order for this to be a violent interaction. And so this is something that I'm telling, like, not even just on the cows, but other people, because I think I can't speak for everyone. And I don't want to make these like societal claims like, oh, society makes women like this, even though I could. I don't necessarily want to. I just don't think that we're taught how to trust that intuition and what it is and have confidence in who we are and to make sure that like no means no. Like even him saying that like a couple of times, like before in one of the study clubs, like, that's something I have to work with. Like I said, no. And then I'll find myself explaining it. And it's like, no, no means no, even something so simple. So some of this I should have learned a very, very long time ago. Would I have benefited? Absolutely. And there are times that I'm just so grateful that like I'm alive, because I really do believe that had I not made certain choices, just however I made those choices, who really, really knows. Like, it has gotten to the point where, like, I'm double, triple checking my locks, regretting that I invited this person to my house so now they know where I live, or, like, panicking if I see a certain car and I'm like, wait, that car shouldn't be here. Those type of things I actually have experienced. So, yeah, I really do thank you all for listening.
Thank you for sharing, Emmy. I'm sorry to hear that you've had so much trauma. That is what the system of white supremacy is designed to produce. But that is one of the reasons why I thought it would be good to read this book. I think I said at the very beginning, victims of white supremacy, we are abused all the time by white people and non-white people. That's what all of this is about. And so I thought this book might have some helpful tidbits based on what Emmy, others said, helpful tidbits so that we could avoid some of that trauma, conflict, so that we don't have what she just mentioned, that accumulation of just horrible experiences with white people and or non-white people. Did we miss anybody? Anybody else have a hand up with commentary that we didn't get their hand yet?
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, everyone. Into thinking about the first half of the reading, I would say that as a recommendation to non-white people, both male and female, is to read Mr. Fuller's code book in People Activity of Sex, especially on this matter, even before this book, because it's obvious that this white person, racist suspect, is not going to come from the context of racism, white supremacy. Although there are some things that he's talking about that are synonymous, and it's needed to be known by victims of racism, white supremacy, it's not going to be proficient enough for us to us as non-white people who are victims of racism, white supremacy, which is the major product of abuse, is the global system of racism, white supremacy. In Mr. Fuller's book, as you've already mentioned, the instructions with females, he suggested this is first time, last time. Even before that process, what non-white people, non-white black people included, do not do, apparently, is before we get serious with a person is not asking enough questions, especially intrinsic questions. And at any time that you or the other person is not willing to ask or answer a question, it must mean that the level of the relationship and how far it goes doesn't go any further. Because that person, whether it's myself or the other person, is not prepared to answer the question or is not going to answer the question in a truthful manner. With the fear that they may reveal something that they do not want the other person to know. And he makes it essential that before a person gets serious with another person, that they know everything about that person that they possibly can. But the book is only coming from a... Let me ask you a question about the book. This book was written in what year?
1997.
Oh, the reason why I'm chuckling on it is because after 1997, there sure has been a lot of murder, abuse on the job. That's been, I put it this way, I don't know about the statistics on whether or not it rise and fall, but it certainly has been since 1997, a whole lot of murders in the people activity of employment since that time. So I don't know on exactly on what reason why his book is not if it is supposed to be effective, that it has not been endorsed to the level to whereas apparently that rate of employment murder have lessened. So maybe he does have some points to quote unquote look out for when someone's being fired, and that's in a lot of cases that's there's been several mass shootings over that issue that certainly has been after 1997. Matter of fact, in the last couple of years, it's been a national phenomenon with that subject matter. You know, so it's something to consider. And I would say white people are much aware of this issue and how it evolves in the context of racism, white supremacy, more so than their victims do. That's why non-white people are victims, because of the lack of knowledge that they have over the perpetrators, the major perpetrators, which are white people. But he does not, and I don't think he is, going to exclusively mention violence in the form of racism, white supremacy. And that's my report. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. Any heartfelt story. Man, that's tough. I just pray that, you know, my daughters are never in that type of situation. I've been fired a few times. You know, I prefer the professional firing, you know, where you walk in there and you didn't know that's what was going to happen. And, you know, like, you know, it's two people, like, that's from HR that you never speak to. You know, I don't have to deal with the white supremacist or anything else. You know, just, you know, hey, sign this paper, you know. I got a few questions, you know, for them, and I'm on my way. You know, like, I prefer that kind. I've been into the situation where you had someone who you're disagreeing with, you know, and that never works out well. You know, this, to me, to avoid conflict for everyone, this is definitely how you would do it. I would imagine the gentleman who put a couple bullets on the desk of the employer had to be a white man, because if a black person did that, you know, they wouldn't have got their $400 and they probably would have got 40 years, you know? So I would imagine he said, hey, pay this white man. If he got a bunch of guns in the house, you know, he might come up here and shoot everybody. And I think the other white people say, you're probably right. The victim comment, Gus, that was a very interesting thing. You know, the one time, I mean, how long can you be a victim? You know, especially if you know it's you're being abused, and now in some instances you're choosing, you know, to stay in that relationship. Although in our instance, it's really, you know, nowhere else to go. So it's just a very interesting spin on it. Definitely from a white person. I spoke on the show several times about the OJ trial. We talked about how many times the cops showed up to victims, in particular Nicole Brown Smith, and didn't do anything to OJ. If I recall, OJ would probably be in prison with the evidence, if the evidence wasn't found by a cop who hopped the gate, you know, found the glove and happened to use nigga 30-something times in the tape and used a pregnant black woman as a shield against drug dealers and everything else in his statement. So I really think that him, not to mention Mark Furman, and that whole thing is very interesting, you know, because it was, I mean, based off the evidence that white people presented, if he wasn't there, you know, OJ would have, you know, but OJ was punished later, I guess in 1997. He didn't know that, but I'm pretty sure as a white person, he knew that his day was coming. I'll mute my line, Gus. Thank you.
Much obliged. I could hear, or at least in my mind, well, before I even get to that, whoo, I am muted. I have my mute button on because frequently I'm snickering at things that are not appropriate or making comments out loud. I'm generally not a quiet listener, although I do listen attentively, just not quietly. But when Thomas in New York was saying, you know, I'm a victim of racism, unfortunately, I've been fired. I have as well. I'm saying that he preferred the professional manner since he's shared with us on workplace racism about being terminated. I was thinking in my mind about the accusations about the fruit. And I had the image in my mind of the attorneys at their highfalutin New York office and coming in and being like, you know, we've got serious accusations that you've been stealing fruit money. We've got video of you smuggling apricots. And we're going to have to terminate you in one. Like, that's not funny at all. But that is what I was thinking in my mind, stealing watermelons. And we're going to do our professional firing. We can forward your email, letters, any other produce utensils you need. Woo! Anyway, I was thinking Mr. DeBecker might have said, you know, I didn't mention Mr. Furman because I didn't want to make this about race. I didn't want playing the race card and bringing all that up, you know, the scheme team like they did in the trial. Maybe that's what he would say. I would not buy that at all for exactly the reasons that I said last week. That would be acceptable if you don't bring up Al Sharpton. You can't be mentioning O.J. Simpson a bunch of times. This isn't the first time that you brought up O.J. Simpson. He had the kamikaze reference before. I just went to the dictionary on that one. That goes straight to World War II. That's a white supremacy reference as well. You can't have all the Central Park jogger case because this was closer to that. You can't have all of these references to incidents, episodes, historic episodes, some of the globally historic episodes that are all about white supremacy racism. How can you talk about O.J. Simpson and not talk about racism, white supremacy, and Mark Furman? That sort of effort to not directly just go ahead and mention racism if you're going to talk about violence and abuse and white supremacy is the greatest form of abuse, that to me becomes you're doing this deliberately. You're practicing racism. You're being deceptive. You're deliberately not mentioning white people, abusing, terrorizing non-white people. This book came out the year, I think, that Enes Kanter was killed. I don't know if it was before or after. I'd have to look at the exact, months to see what the case was. But I mean, hey, at minimum, he would have been working on this book, preparing for the publication and lecture tours and all that. Did the Enes Kanter murder get mentioned in that, and tips that he and his son, especially if that was connected to racism, white supremacy, because that's a cowbell, just like O.J. Simpson. Let me get to my notes. Fooling around, jokes with Thomas in New York got me off track. All right.
Gus, can I say one thing, please?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
If he was to remake this book, I guarantee Bill Cosby will be in it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. We're not going to mention Enes, but old Bill, yes, indeed. Serial terrorist. That's what they called him, a serial sexual terrorist. Bill Cosby would have been in here. OJ, Bill, and Al Sharpton. So let me get my note. I took a lot of notes this week, more than I've taken in a while. So we didn't finish all of Chapter 9 last week, so I have to even go back to Chapter 9 for this week. Wow. All right. The information about the employees, he said, talking about a white man, when Thomas in New York, I thought that was a great point. That had to be a white person to put a bullet on a coworker's desk and to get a $400 reimbursement as opposed to prison sentence. They got this type of employee is very sensitive and perceptive about being handled, particularly if it's because of a concern that he will act violently. If he perceives that employers consider him dangerous, it can actually increase the likelihood of his acting out because he has little to lose when he is already thought of as violent. I cannot imagine this being true for a black person. I can't imagine a black person in a workplace where they think this is someone who is violent and crazy and he's going to be allowed to work here. Like, that, stealing fruit. I mean, I just can't. That's not my experience under the system of racism, white supremacy. Let's see. I think Emmy talked about the nuance and his attention to detail. I do think that that is important. He offers a lot of very specific suggestions for a lot of different settings that might be helpful in minimizing violence. I can certainly appreciate that. Moving to chapter 10. We already had one reference to Dr. Marimba Anees Yarugu. In that book, first book we read in the book club, she said that there's no such thing as objectivity. She was especially talking about writing, journalism, anything like that. She's like, you really, if you want to be transparent, as they say, honest, just be upfront about what your politics are as you do your work. Fine. Now everybody knows what's happening. With this, be upfront. Like, don't, you know, say that you're giving me objective information. Just be upfront with your politics. If you're going to mention O.J. Simpson a bunch in the book, because this is not the first time that he mentioned O.J. Simpson, be upfront with that. This book came out 2 years after the trial. Be upfront with that. Have O.J. on the front of the book. And that gets to a major point of why I continue to bring up racism in this book, because it seems like he's working so hard not to mention it explicitly, but it's there in all these veiled forms where he can practice white supremacy. He can mention Al Sharpton as a bad guy without any real information. He can mention O.J. Simpson as the worst wife beater ever, and how can anybody not be convinced, call him a killer even though he was acquitted. He can get away with all of this in this text because he is not talking about mentioning racism. And in my view, he is promoting white people's biggest fear is already O.J. Simpson. Al Sharpton is exactly what they say. Black people, that's already what they say their biggest fear are. Biggest fear is. Rodney King, you mentioned LAPD. He's doing a great job of that in a book which doesn't even directly mention white supremacy. He starts chapter 10. I don't see how anyone could have doubts after hearing the eloquent prosecutor. He already mentioned he was hired by the prosecution. That's what I mean. Like, and you can't put distance between those statements. Be upfront. Go ahead and remind us. Oh, yeah, I was employed by the prosecution. I do have a relationship there, so I'm not exactly objective, as they say. I got a dog in the race on this one. I was definitely rooting against the juice on this one. Say that. Remind us of that. When he says the eloquent prosecutor described the case, and already that pits it. If I did have doubts about this case, about whether or not he did it, there must be something wrong with me. Maybe I'm illogical. I didn't look at all the facts correct. He worked on the case. He must know some things that I don't know. Again, no footnotes with this book. No footnotes to say that, man. Let's see. Continue. Said, I worked with the prosecution. He mentions it on the next page. Tell me up front. I worked with the prosecution on the stalking aspects of the Simpson criminal trial and later on the civil suit brought by the Goldman family. But I don't discuss the case here as an advocate. Really? Your name calling them. I don't remember Johnny Cochran, anyone calling themselves the scheme team. Did anyone have paraphernalia? I was a child at that time. Oh, wait a minute. I guess I was no longer a child by then, but I was pretty young and ignorant about the system of white supremacy racism at that point. Did anyone have paraphernalia? Scheme team paraphernalia? I do not remember that. A T-shirt, a baseball cap, none of the above. A glove that barely fits that says scheme team. Well, I do not remember that at all. Don't name call and call O.J. Simpson a killer and then tell me in the same breath, oh, no, I didn't come here to advocate for a prosecution team that I was employed with. Come on, Mr. DeBeck. And that's one like, man, did Oprah Winfrey bring that up? Because, I mean, that's ridiculous. Like, that is in my view, you're not even being credible as an author. Like, that's the sort of thing that should be brought up. Just come out and say all that from the beginning, that you want to make sure you get in a few jabs on OJ and Gift of Fear. No, and Al Sharpton, too. Let's see. Next up. Scheme team. He used the word terrorized. I mentioned this because white people are exceptional with use of words. Mr. DeBecker spent all that time in the preceding chapters talking about closely scrutinizing words that people use. Is this a threat or is this someone who's just trying to be intimidating? And discerning whether or not you need to take this just by examining what they say. He knows the importance of words. He used the word terrorized. James Loewen, we just read his great big book, Sundown Towns. The only times he used the word terror, terrorism, terrorized, were when he was directly quoting someone else. And it only popped up in the book like a handful of times, as opposed to race relations, which was every other page. Terrorized O.J. Simpson, who beat his wife, broke into her home, threatened her at least once with a gun, terrorized her, and stalked her. O.J. Simpson, a terrorist. Let's see. Oh, and the metaphors. Someone talks about metaphors on a regular basis. He says the scheme team's observation that not everyone who beats his wife doesn't mean that he killed her. The scheme team's observation is a little like saying just because someone buys dough doesn't mean he's going to make pizza, and that's true. But if he buys dough, spreads it around on a tin tray, adds tomato sauce, adds cheese, and puts it in the oven, then, even if Simpson lawyer Alan Dershowitz tells you differently, you can be comfortable predicting that pizza is being made. And then he goes to explain why he calls them the scheme team. He goes down, and then on the same page where he explains why he calls them the scheme team, he says Simpson was killing Nicole for years. She finally died on June 12th. This is a direct quote from LA's forward-thinking domestic violence council. I thought Mr. Simpson was acquitted of murder. Court said he didn't kill anybody, but then they can come back and he'd been killing her for years. Let's see. Oh, and then he comes right after that. He says, despite the misinformation offered to the American public by paid advocates in service of just one man, O.J. Simpson, there are many reliable pre-incident indicators associated with spousal violence and murder. Are you not entitled to legal counsel? Paid legal counsel and or otherwise? I thought that was a constitutional right. He follows all that up with a great list. I thought that's, as Emmy talked about, having details that you can be attentive about, things that you can look out for that might be what they call red flags. I thought that was great. and then he slipped in a jab right as at the end of this little section, too, on OJ. He says, unlike some murderers, spousal homicide is a crime that can strike with a conscience. This is after he got all these letters from spousal abusers who recognized their own behavior in the Simpson trial and I guess felt guilty and wrote in that they have a conscience, unlike that no good O.J. Simpson. Continuing, greatest theme in the system of white supremacy. They are afraid of the no good black male raping, assaulting, terrorizing the white woman. Comes up frequently in even Sundown Towns. I think we got a few of those. Let's see. He says we must hold abusive men accountable. We must hold white people who practice racism, white supremacy accountable. And speaking of metaphors, I'll get this one in and then we can get to the second audio. I certainly appreciate that there are lots of females who are victims of domestic violence. We talked about with the man knot, there are lots of black males who are also victims of domestic violence, and children as well. And I hope if we have any listeners who are in those unfortunate circumstances, if you get any constructive information from the text, that is one of the reasons why we are reading this book. That said, him using the metaphor, he says how to choose the best time to run and how not to be tracked when they escape, talking about females victims of domestic violence, when they escape into the modern day underground railroad shelters have become. That metaphor is massively incorrect. That would be another reference to racism, white supremacy. I don't care how bad your situation is. If you're in an arrangement with O.J. Simpson, most notorious abuser in the history of L.A., as he says, or any other situation, Jimmy Savile, Jerry Sandusky, any situation, that is not comparable to slavery. I say that every compensatory call-in, metaphors, deception, making comparisons that are not accurate. If you are a runaway slave, you have, as we read in Edward Baptist, the half has never been told, an entire white nation out to get you. Not one person. If you're in a domestic arrangement, O.J. Simpson does not have slave catchers out to track down Nicole Brown Simpson. I didn't see that. Does he have a footnote? Does somebody have evidence of that? I don't care what your domestic abuse situation is. They are not gangs with guns and dogs out to get you, kill you, maim you, and drag you back. That is not happening unless I am way, way in error, where federal officers can even be enlisted in dragging you back. That is not happening at all. That is a flagrantly inaccurate metaphor, an act of racism, white supremacy, in my view, unless I have been mistaken. And if anyone listening, archived and or live, feels that I've been in error with that statement, make sure you speak up before we go off air. With that, we will get to audio segment number two. If you had additional comments, questions you would like to share, write a note. We should have ample time once we finish up. This is Gavin DeBecker, The Gift of Fear. So we're picking up. We're still in chapter 10, about halfway through or so. Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number two.
Just as there are batterers who will victimize partner after partner, so are there serial victims, women who will select more than one violent man. Given that violence is often the result of an inability to influence events in any other way, and that this is often the result of an inability or unwillingness to effectively communicate, it's interesting to consider the wide appeal of the so-called strong and silent type. The reason often cited by women for the attraction is that the silent man is mysterious. And it may be that physical strength, which in evolutionary terms brought security, now adds an element of danger. The combination means that one cannot be completely certain what this man is feeling or thinking, because he is silent. And there might be fairly high stakes, because he's strong and potentially dangerous. I asked a friend, who has often followed her attraction to the strong and silent type, how long she likes men to remain silent. "About 2 or 3 weeks," she answered. "Just long enough to get me interested. I like to be intrigued, not tricked. The tough part is finding someone who is mysterious but not secretive, strong but not scary." One of the most common errors in selecting a boyfriend or spouse is basing the prediction on potential. This is actually predicting what certain elements might add up to in some different context. He isn't working now, but he could be really successful. He's going to be a great artist. Of course, he can't paint under present circumstances. He's a little edgy and aggressive these days, but that's just until he gets settled. Listen to the words. Isn't working, can't paint, is aggressive. What a person is doing now is the context for successful predictions. And marrying a man on the basis of potential, or for that matter, hiring an employee solely on the basis of potential, is a sure way to interfere with intuition. That's because the focus on potential carries our imagination to how things might be or could be, and away from how they are now. Spousal abuse is committed by people who are, with remarkable frequency, described by their victims as having been the sweetest, the gentlest, the kindest, and most attentive, etc. Indeed, many were all of these things during the selection process, and often still are, between violent incidents. But even though these men are frequently kind and gentle in the beginning, there are always warning signs. Victims, however, may not always choose to detect them. I made these points on a recent television interview, and a woman called in and said, "You're wrong. There's no way you can tell when a man will turn out to be violent. It just happens out of nowhere." She went on to describe how her ex-husband, an avid collector of weapons, became possessive immediately after their marriage, made her account for all of her time, didn't allow her to have a car, and frequently displayed jealousy. Could these things have been warning signs? In continuing her description of this awful man, she said, "His first wife died as a result of beatings he gave her." Could that have been a warning sign? But people don't see the signs, maybe because our process of falling in love is in large measure the process of choosing not to see faults, and that requires some denial. This denial is doubtless necessary in a culture that glorifies the kind of romance that leads young couples to rush to get married in spite of all the reasons they shouldn't, and 50-year-old men to follow what is euphemistically called their hearts into relationships with their young secretaries and out of relationships with their middle-aged wives. This is, frankly, the kind of romance that leads to more failed relationships than successful ones. The way our culture pursues romance and mating is not the way of the whole world. Even here within our nation is another nation of Native Americans, whose culture historically involved arranged marriages. The man and the woman were selected by tribal elders, told to live together, and quite possibly, without a scintilla of attraction, told to build a life together. For such relationships to succeed, the partners had to look for favorable attributes in each other. This is the exact opposite of the process most Americans use, that of not looking at the unfavorable attributes. The issue of selection and choice brings to mind the important work of psychologist Nathaniel Brandon, author of Honoring the Self. He tells of the woman who says, "I have the worst luck with men. Over and over again, I find myself in these relationships with men who are abusive. I just have the worst luck." Luck has very little to do with it, because the glaringly common characteristic of each of this woman's relationships is her. My observations about selection are offered to enlighten victims, not to blame them, for I don't believe that violence is a fair penalty for bad choices, but I do believe they are choices. Though leaving is the best response to violence, it's in trying to leave that most women get killed. This dispels a dangerous myth about spousal killings, that they happen in the heat of argument. In fact, the majority of husbands who kill their wives stalk them first, and far from the crime of passion that it's so often called, killing a wife is usually a decision, not a loss of control. Those men who are the most violent are not at all carried away by fury. In fact, their heart rates actually drop, and they become physiologically calmer as they become more violent. Even the phrase crime of passion has contributed to our widespread misunderstanding of this violence. That phrase is not the description of a crime. It is the description of an excuse, a defense. Since 75% of spousal murders happen after the woman leaves, it is estrangement, not argument, that begets the worst violence. In the end, stalking is not just about cases of fatal attraction. Far more often, it's about cases of fatal inaction in which the woman stayed too long. Of all the violence discussed in this book, spousal homicide is the most predictable, yet people are reluctant to predict it. A man in Los Angeles was recently accused of killing his wife, three of his children, and three other family members. News reporters questioning neighbors about the accused murderer were told, "He always seemed normal." Another said, "He must be crazy." And another said, "I can't imagine that a father would kill his own children." As you know, if you cannot imagine it, you cannot predict it. When will we have seen this story often enough to realize that if several members of a family are killed, it was probably done by another member of that family? In this case, the man neighbors couldn't imagine was responsible for the murders had already tried to kill his wife three other times. He had also been arrested twice on domestic violence charges. Sounds predictable to me. So how does the system usually respond to society's most predictable murder risk? It tells the woman to go to court, to civil court, and sue her abuser to stay away. In many states, this is called a temporary restraining order, because it's expected to restrain the aggressor. In some states, it's called a protection order, expected to protect the victim. In fact, on its own, it doesn't achieve either goal. Lawyers, police, TV news people, counselors, psychologists, and even some victims' advocates recommend restraining orders wholesale. They are a growth industry in this country. We should perhaps consider putting them on the New York Stock Exchange, but we should stop telling people that a piece of paper will automatically protect them, because when applied to certain types of cases, it may do the opposite. It's dangerous to promote a specific treatment without first diagnosing the problem in the individual case. It's perhaps obvious to say that a restraining order will not restrain a murderer, but there is substantial controversy on the topic. While I warn that they should not be universally recommended because they aren't right for every kind of case or every stage of a case, most police departments encourage them all the time. Restraining orders, often called TROs, have long been homework assignments police give women to prove they're really committed to getting away from their pursuers. The orders do get the troubled women out of the police station and headed for court, perhaps to have continuing problems, perhaps not. And they do make arrests simpler if a man continues his unwanted pursuit. Thus, TROs clearly serve police and prosecutors, but they do not always serve victims. In California, for example, TROs are valid for only 14 days, after which the woman must return to court for a trial to determine if the order will be extended. Even with all the failures of the present system, there are those who aggressively defend it, including one psychiatrist who has been a loyal apologist for the status quo. At a large police conference, he trumpeted, "TROs work, and we have proven it." He based his reckless statement on a woefully biased study of a small sample of stalking cases that didn't even include spousal stalkers, the very type most likely to kill. In fact, if you work back from the murders, you'll find restraining orders and other confrontational interventions alarmingly often. The personal effects of a woman murdered by her estranged husband frequently include the piece of paper that psychiatrist assured us has been proven effective. How does he explain that? "Look at it this way," he says. "Some people die on chemotherapy. Some people die when they get restraining orders. But that doesn't mean that you don't do chemo or that you don't get restraining orders." The doctor's comparison of cancer, which the afflicted patient cannot get away from, with the risks posed by an estranged husband, which the woman can get away from, is not only callous, but dangerously flawed. Since so many women die as a result of this type of careless thinking, and because most of those deaths are preventable, I'm going to go several layers deeper into the topic. I hope you never need this information for yourself, but I know that someone in your life will need it sometime. Many homicides have occurred at the courthouse, where the women are seeking protection orders, or just prior to the hearings. Why? Because the murderers were allergic to rejection. They found it hard enough in private, but intolerable in public. For men like this, rejection is a threat to the identity, the persona, to the entire self. And in this sense, their crimes could be called murder in defense of the self. In To Have or To Harm, the first major book on stalking, author Lyndon Gross details case after case in which court orders did not prevent homicides. Here are just a few. Shirley Lowry was waiting outside the courtroom for the TRO hearing when she was stabbed 19 times by her husband. Tammy Marie Davis's husband beat and terrorized her and their 21-month-old child, sending them both to the hospital. Right after he was served with the restraining order Tammy obtained, he shot and killed her. She was 19 years old. Donna Montgomery's husband had held a gun to her head and stalked her, so she obtained a restraining order. He came to the bank where she worked and killed her, then himself. Teresa Bender obtained a restraining order that her husband quickly violated. Even though he was arrested, she remained so committed to her safety that she arranged for two male co-workers to accompany her to and from work. Her husband was equally committed. He shot all three to death before turning the gun on himself. Maria Navarro called 911 and reported that her estranged husband had just threatened to kill her and was on the way to her house. Despite the fact that he'd been arrested more than once for battery, police declined to dispatch officers to her home because her restraining order had expired. Maria and three others were dead within 15 minutes, murdered by the man who kept his promise to kill. Hilda Rivera's husband had violated two restraining orders and had six arrest warrants when he killed her in the presence of their 7-year-old son. Betsy Murray's husband violated his TRO 13 times. He reacted to her divorce petition by telling her, "Marriage is for life, and the only way out is death." When nothing else worked, Betsy went into hiding. And even after police assured her that her husband had fled the country to avoid being arrested again, she still kept her new address a secret. When she stopped by her old apartment one day to collect mail a neighbor had been holding, her estranged husband killed her and then himself. He had been stalking her for more than 6 months. The fact that so many of these murderers also commit suicide tells us that refusing to accept rejection is more important to them than life itself. By the time they reach this point, are they really going to be deterred by a court order? The last case I want to cite is that of Connie Chaney. She had already obtained 4 protective orders when her husband raped her at gunpoint and attempted to kill her. The solution recommended by police? Get a restraining order. So she did. Before gunning her down, her husband wrote in his diary, "I couldn't live with myself knowing she won, or she got me. No, this is war." Those 3 words speak it all, because the restraining order is like a strategy of war, and the stakes are life and death, just as in war. In a study of 179 stalking cases sponsored by the San Diego District Attorney's Office, about half of the victims who had sought restraining orders felt their cases were worsened by them. In a study done for the U.S. Department of Justice, researchers concluded that restraining orders were ineffective in stopping physical violence. They did find that restraining orders were helpful in cases in which there was no history of violent abuse. The report wisely concluded that, given the prevalence of women with children who utilize restraining orders, their general ineffectiveness in curbing subsequent violence may leave a good number of children at risk of either witnessing violence or becoming victims themselves. A more recent study done for the U.S. Department of Justice found that more than a third of women had continuing problems after getting restraining orders. That means, favorably, that almost two-thirds did not have continuing problems. But read on. While only 2.6% of respondents were physically abused right after getting the orders, when they were recontacted 6 months later, that percentage had more than tripled. Reports of continued stalking and psychological abuse also increased dramatically after 6 months. This indicates that the short-term benefits of restraining orders are greater than the long-term benefits. I want to make clear that I'm not saying TROs never work, because in fact, most times that court orders are introduced, the cases do improve. It is often for the very reason one would hope. The men are deterred by the threat of arrest. Other times, TROs demonstrate the woman's resolve to end the relationship, and that convinces the man to stay away. Whatever the reasons they work, there is no argument that they don't work in some cases. The question is, which cases? Restraining orders are most effective on the reasonable person who has a limited emotional investment. In other words, they work best on the person least likely to be violent anyway. Also, there is a substantial difference between using a restraining order on an abusive husband and using one on a man you dated a couple of times. That difference is the amount of emotional investment and entitlement the man feels. With a date stalker, discussed in the next chapter, a TRO orders him to leave the woman alone and go about his life as it was before he met her. The same court order, used on an estranged husband, asks him to abandon, at the stroke of a judge's signature, the central features of his life, his intimate relationship, his control and ownership of another human being, his identity as a powerful man, his identity as a husband, and on and on. Thus, a TRO might ask one man to do something he can easily do, while it asks another to do something far more difficult. This distinction has been largely ignored by the criminal justice system. There is a glib response to all this. When men are very violent and dangerous, they are going to kill no matter what, so the TRO can't make things worse. But here's the rub. The TRO does hurt by convincing the woman that she is safe. One prominent family court judge has said, "Women must realize that this paper won't stop the next fist or the next bullet." But it isn't only women who must realize it. It is the whole criminal justice system. A woman can be expected to learn from her own experience, but the system should learn from all the experiences. Carol Arnett has had experience running a battered women's shelter and, years before that, running to a battered women's shelter. Now the executive director of the Los Angeles County Domestic Violence Council, Arnett says, "We shelter workers have watched the criminal justice system fail to protect, and often even endanger women for so many years that we are very cautious about recommending restraining orders. We rely upon the woman herself to plan a course of action. Anyone, in or out of the system, who tells a woman she must follow a particular course that goes against her own judgment and intuition is not only failing to use the philosophy of empowerment, but may well be endangering the woman. Above all, I want to encourage people to ask this simple question: will a restraining order help or hurt in my particular case? At least then, whatever choice is made can be called a choice and not an automatic reaction. Think of restraining orders as an option, not the only option. Among those options, I certainly favor law enforcement interventions such as arrests for battery, assault, breaking and entering, or other violations of the law. You might wonder how this differs from being arrested for violating a TRO. Charges for breaking the law involve the system versus the lawbreaker, whereas restraining orders involve an abuser versus his wife. Many batterers find intolerable the idea of being under the control of their victims, and with a court order, a woman seeks to control her husband's conduct, thus turning the tables of their relationship. Conversely, when the system pursues charges for a crime like battery, it is the man's actions, not those of his wife, that bring him a predictable consequence. Abusers should be fully prosecuted for every offense, and I believe prosecutions are an important deterrent to further abuse. But even then, the women must be prepared for the possibility of escalation. The bottom line is that there is really only one good reason to get a restraining order in a case of wife abuse. The woman believes the man will honor it and leave her alone. If a victim or a professional in the system gets a restraining order to stop someone from committing murder, they have probably applied the wrong strategy. So what can we tell a woman who thinks she might be killed? Seek and apply strategies that make you unavailable to your pursuer. If you really believe you are at risk, battered women's shelters provide the best way to be safe. Shelter locations are secret, and the professionals there understand what the legal system often doesn't, that the issue is safety, not justice. The distinction between safety and justice is often blurred, but it becomes clear when you are walking down a crowded city sidewalk and an athletic young man grabs your purse or briefcase. As he runs off into fast-moving traffic, justice requires that you chase the youth down to catch and arrest him. But as he zigzags through traffic, cars barely missing him, safety requires that you break off the chase. It's unfair that he gets away unpunished, but it's more important that you come away unhurt. To remind clients that my job is to help them be safer, I have a small sign on my desk that reads, "Do not come here for justice." Shelters are where safety is, where guidance is, and where wisdom is. Admittedly, going to a shelter is a major and inconvenient undertaking, and it's easy to see why so many victims are lured by the good news that a restraining order will solve the whole problem. But imagine that your doctor said you needed immediate surgery to save your life. Would you ask, "Isn't there a piece of paper I can carry instead?" Los Angeles City Attorney John Wilson, a thoughtful and experienced man who pioneered the nation's first stalking prosecutions, knows of too many cases in which the victim remained available to her victimizer after the man was arrested and released. Wilson attended a talk I gave to police executives, and he later wrote to me, "I am comfortable sharing this part of his moving letter." Your theme really hit home. Unfortunately, for one young wife, I failed to heed your advice in mid-April. I filed a battery on her husband, and when he got out of jail, he killed her. This was my sixth death since joining the office, and each of them fit right into your profile. Having read all of this, you may wonder how there is any disagreement whatsoever about the indiscriminate use of restraining orders and other confrontational interventions. But there is. I've heard all sides of the issue, and I must tell you, I don't get it. Perhaps since TROs are issued in America at the rate of more than 1,000 every day, and women aren't killed at that same rate, it may look, statistically speaking, as if they're successful. I don't know, but in any case, and in every case, police must urge extreme caution in the period following issuance of a TRO. That time is emotionally charged and hazardous. And I hope that when police recommend restraining orders, they will also put great effort into ensuring that the woman takes every practical step to make herself unavailable to her pursuer. Psychologist Lenore Walker, who coined the term battered wife syndrome, and who later surprised the domestic violence community by joining O.J. Simpson's defense team, has said of spousal homicide, "There's no way to predict it." She is wrong. Spousal homicide is the single most predictable serious crime in America. Walker's error does make clear, however, that there is an urgent need to help police, prosecutors, and victims systematically evaluate cases to identify those with the ingredients of true danger. Toward this goal, my firm designed Mosaic 20, an artificial intuition system that assesses the details of a woman's situation as she reports it to police. This computer program flags those cases in which the danger of homicide is highest. Part of the proceeds from this book go to its continued development, and I'm proud to be working with the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office, the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, and the Los Angeles Police Department on the nation's first use of Mosaic 20. This system brings to regular citizens the same technologies and strategies used to protect high government officials. That's only fair, considering that battered women are at far greater risk of murder than most public figures. In the meantime, restraining orders continue to be what author Lyndon Groves calls law enforcement's knee-jerk response. I can't ask rhetorically if somebody has to die before things change, because so many people already have. Thousands of cases have made it clear to me that getting away safely is wiser than trying to change the abusive husband or engaging in a war, even if the police and the courts are on your side. As with other aspects of safety, government cannot fix violent relationships. Many people in law enforcement, motivated by a strong desire to help, are understandably reluctant to accept that some forms of criminality are beyond their reach. Thankfully, there are also those in law enforcement, tempered by experience, who know all about these cases and become heroes. That brings me to Lisa's story. Lisa didn't know that this police sergeant had looked across the counter into plenty of bruised faces before that night. She thought her situation was unique and special, and she was certain the department would act on it right away, particularly when she explained that her husband had held a gun to her head. An hour earlier, after climbing out the window and running down several darkened streets, she had looked around and realized she was lost. But in a more important sense, she was found. She had rediscovered herself, the young woman she'd been 15 years before he'd slapped her, before he escalated to choking her, and before the incident with a gun. The children had seen that one, and now they would see her stronger, supported by the police. They would see him apologize, and then it would be okay. The police would talk some sense into her husband and force him to treat her right, and then it would be okay. She proudly told the sergeant, "I'm not going back to him unless he promises never to hit me again." The sergeant nodded and passed some forms across the counter. "You fill these out. Fill them out completely, and then I'm going to put them over there." He pointed to a messy stack of forms and reports piled on a cabinet. The sergeant looked at the young woman, the woman planning to go back to her abuser, back to the man with a gun he claimed he bought for self-defense, but was really for defense of the self. The sergeant then said the words that changed Lisa's life, the words that a decade later she would thank him for speaking, the words that allowed her to leave her violent abuser. "You fill out these forms and go back home, and the next time I look for them, it'll be because you have been murdered."
That will do it for this week's section of Gavin DeBecker's The Gift of Fear. We are almost done. I think we have like two sessions left, and then we'll be on to a new book. I think that new book is going to be John Grisham's Sycamore Row. I certainly will solicit for other potential books if folks have suggestions. If you feel like narrating, that is always awesome. Mumia Abu-Jamal, Live from Death Row. That's a good one to have to think. But I was really thinking Sycamore Row. It's still technically summertime, and it will be when we finish this book. So always appreciate being able to get in one fiction book, especially in the summertime. So Sycamore Row, Dr. Welsing enjoyed that text and talked about it on the program in the archives. So that's another reason why I was thinking maybe we should read that one. It's about people's favorite area of people activity, Area 8. Anyway, back to this book. Again, if we have any listeners and you are dealing with any aspect of abuse, violence that has been discussed in the book or our discussions, if some of this information is helpful, that is why we are reading the book. If it can be applied to your situation to help you make better sense, maybe make safer choices? Bravo. That is why we are reading the book. And again, the system of white supremacy is designed for black people to be harmed by everyone, white people and non-white people. Anti-blackness is a huge component of white supremacy, racism, and black people harming other black people. So there is lots of that happening worldwide. That is one of the reasons we're reading the book. The number to dial, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Anyone who thinks my commentary about that being a flagrantly inaccurate comparison and an act of racism deliberate, in my view, by the author, comparing modern day shelters for victims of domestic abuse to the Underground Railroad, make sure you speak up. Just want to make sure if I'm talking nutty, saying things that are not logical, don't make sense, that is not allowed to proceed without being detected, called out. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, and if you haven't shared at all, if we missed you the first time around, definitely get your hand up immediately. Don't wait till the last minute. You dialed star 61, should be with us. Line should be open. Feel free to share.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Thomas in New York.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings again. Man, I thought that Rice about getting the police involved and filing actually charges as opposed to just getting a restraining order was pretty good advice for white people. I don't think black people ever want to get the police involved, but, you know, we have a different interaction with them. But I think that that was good advice for women who are serious, you don't want to be bothered with this person, and instead of, you know, getting a piece of paper that kind of changes the tide, you know, you file charges, which is pretty final. Man, what happens when you can't avoid your abuser? You know, you can't always just avoid them. What happens when you can't run to a shelter? You know, they own the shelter. You know, I mean, what happens is you can't avoid white people. I mean, they have a ghetto pass, you know, called the police. They come whenever they want, any neighborhood, doesn't matter. You know, it's no way to avoid this. You know, this. I mean, I think this really does apply strictly. You can apply some of his logic to, you know, white supremacy, and some of it just doesn't apply. Because, you know, of course, the issues of domestic violence and the issues of racial violence or racist violence is two totally different things that white people have tried since the 60s, probably even before that, to merge. They were successful in the 60s, merging those two things together, you know, to give white women civil rights and things. But it's just two different things. It doesn't add up. Lastly, back to the first meeting, O.J. Simpson, you know, it just had me thinking, like, you know, is O.J. that dangerous? I mean, he killed Nicole Brown Simpson, and so they say, and Richard Ronald Goldman, whatever his name was. But, yeah, I mean, I'm like, man, Angelo Bruno Jr.? I mean, the Hillside Strangler? 9 women raped and strangled to death? This was before O.J. You know, you got Charles Manson and Helter Skelter, who used women and killed spouse of pedophile woman Polanski. But, you know, you got Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, 13 rapes, 11 murders. Like, I mean, L.A. is notorious for serial murders and people who've done terrible things to white women. And lastly, you have Joseph James DeAngelo, the Golden State Killer, who was still free. They just caught him last year because he took one of his family members took a DNA test, a genealogy test.
But, I mean, this guy has 50 rapes and 13 murders between this. He was still free. Like, how are you putting OJ in that category? I mean, but system of white supremacy, guys. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
The juice. The juice. Retired firefighter.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. I can. I think I can see now on why this book was popular. The last reading, in my mind, was an indication on its popularity. He has maybe personal aspects, as you know, as his profession, to a lot of deadly or unfavorable circumstances. And I can see on the Oprah Winfrey show when this book was being, I hear an echo in the background. Maybe it's me. I don't know for sure.
Oh, I do hear it slightly, or I did hear it. I don't hear it anymore.
Yeah, I can see when he came on the, but coming on Oprah Winfrey's program, it probably was brought up these particular cases that would terrorize anyone, especially females, white and non-white. It is a real situation. I myself, in the job that I was on, actually was on the first responding end of several situations similar to what he described, all of them ending in that person's death. So he's good at that. And we call it on the job telling war stories, so to speak. But as far as solutions, if a white person or a non-white person does not mention the global context of racism, white supremacy, I don't think their solutions are going to be viable collectively or even personally with individuals as far as that concern. And I think it's logical to, if you're working towards making the problem less frequent with you, is that you head it off by, before you get emotionally attached to a person, that you ask questions, you get develop in a relationship questions and answers, you know, and be very patient in that process. That is primarily, I would say, probably the one of the major, if not the major, mistake that are made that ends up in tragedies such as this. That person just didn't come from nowhere. The murderer is what I'm saying, the abuser, didn't just come from nowhere in with this behavior. Apparently, they are pretty good at disguising it from their victims. And the main product of that on this earth is a white person. You know, as far as that concern. And so it's something that we definitely need to consider. And I've already made my point as far as that concern, is that that's, I think I know why the book has become so popular. It's because of the war stories that he tells. Thank you.
That is appealing.
Nothing else.
In the system of white supremacy, those war stories, guts, violence, that is appealing. Reminded me of the wisdom of psychopaths. Yes, ma'am, we heard you, Draptomania.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's, I didn't mean to interrupt you. The fireman. This book kind of like triggered me in a way, kind of put up some, kicked in some, you know, emotions. Because growing up, and, you know, having those experiences, growing up in a very domestic violent household, seeing a lot of violence around me, and also, and just seeing how, like, you know, when you've gone through that and you've seen, you know, like your mother being abused and like that conditioning, that programming, you know, you end up, you know, you end up growing up to think that that's the correct way of that's the way things are supposed to be done. You somewhat, you don't know really how to do anything much different, and you just attract that same thing and even take on those behaviors. You know, you may think that the only way to deal with situations is to balance yourself. You know, just the environment, just all of that thing, how that type of impact, and just being able to, like, kind of look at how that impacted my life also. It does, like I said, it does bring up some issues for me, and it kind of got me a little depressed. But I do find this book is constructive. Just like MA said, my primary purpose when I started listening to the book was basically because I was going through and still am, you know, going through some issues with being stalked and, you know, just always, you know, some type of, I guess, you know, harassment, you know, the issues that I have been going through. So when I initially, and I'm glad that Amy said that, because when I initially read that, I was listening to the audiobook, it was mainly from that perspective. I didn't, you know, look at it from the perspective of counter-racism. So that's definitely another perspective, and I can see how the whole domestic violence and white supremacy, racism, they do tie in together. And I can see how, like the first caller from Nebraska, he was, you know, how he was equating the book and white supremacy. Now, those types of abuses are basically the same things, you know, the conditioning, the brainwashing, the, you know, it's a component of self-esteem. It's all of those things that go hand in hand that, you know, if you don't understand that type of stuff, and I know, you know, it's not about rationalizing away things, but people, the individuals that are going through that stuff or in their types of situation, I can speak for myself, that you may not know. It's almost like Pavlov's dog. You just become, it's just so, just your way of conditioning, and you just don't know, and you're just basically in a reactionary mode at all times, and you just don't know any other way, because that's just the way that you've seen things being addressed and dealt with your whole entire life. So you have to learn, you know, another way to break unconditioned. It's like if you don't learn another way, and if another way is not presented to you, then the only thing you're going to know is what you've experienced and what you've seen. So, it's about like, it's like breaking, it's trying to break a cycle of abuse. It's trauma. It's, you know, post-traumatic slave syndrome. It's you know, it's all of that, you know. So, yeah, I see how all of that does tie in, you know, to the system of white supremacy. And, you know, thank you for allowing me to share, and that's all I want to share.
Much obliged, Draptomania. Let's see.
May I speak?
Yes, sir.
Hi, Stuart, Nebraska. Is that the interference on my line? Hello?
Yes, sir. I heard. I wasn't sure if that was you in Nebraska, if that was somebody, if there was a caller on the Skype line. The caller on the Skype line?
Okay, well.
Was that you?
I hear it a lot.
Maybe not. Okay. We'll get...
Yeah, I hear her kind of a rub.
I guess
I hear it too.
We'll get the caller in Nebraska first, and then we'll get the caller on the Skype line.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to say a couple things, especially that segment where he spoke of, you know, he had the placard on his desk saying, do not come here for justice. Well, you know, if justice is problem solving, he shouldn't have that on his desk. Because, in other words, he's telling people, I'm going to take your money, but ain't going to solve your problem. And that's pretty sad. But the most powerful thing for the most powerful word for the person who is being abused is the word no. No to the abuse, and especially no to not accepting. And that's something that, you know, he's not really covering in this book too much, whether he knows it or not. You know, he speaks a lot about intuition, but intuition just gives you the option to say yes or no. It's still your choice. It still takes a little bit of reason to put up with that, to put that in. And also, I just wanted to say that he says one of the characteristics of an abuser is possessiveness. And each and every time, you know, them folks bring up Sharpton's name or OJ's name or, in this segment, the name of Native Americans, or Natives, I should say, in comparison to westernized standards of courting, they're showing that possessiveness, and they should really look at themselves as abusers. That's my comment. I'll mute my line.
Thank you, caller in Nebraska. Caller on the Skype line, thank you for your patience. If you had questions or comments, proceed.
Hello, are you talking to me?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, okay. Thank you for taking my call. I hope everyone's having the best evening they can have. I guess to answer your question, someone else did about comparing the Underground Railroad, to a battered women's shelter. I just remember when we read Incidents in Life of a Slave Girl, I believe the young lady was under floorboards with rats crawling over her. I'm sure every women's shelter is not a Ritz-Carlton, but it can't be that bad. So I think that's a fair comparison. And also, I believe the women in the shelter, they're probably more protected than the slaves on the Underground Railroad, because there was always someone looking to get, the law was looking. In some instances, the law was looking for them, not just some person who seems to have some mental issues. I guess the thing that this book definitely should remind us all of is that we don't need to be white people don't really need to be an expert in anything. You know, if they say it enough or write it enough, then, you know, they're the best. I'm not saying his experiences that he's given are invalid, but yet with no footnotes and documentation, you know, he's talking about saving people's lives. I'm going to need a little more data to support what you say. Again, I'm not saying that we can say whether he's telling the truth or not. And I do believe the callers, and I'm sorry they went through their experiences. But again, knowing them, I guess, you know, through these phone interactions, of course I would be more likely to believe them than just somebody who wrote a book. But this is a white person that wrote a book. So yay, he's wonderful. Woohoo, take his advice. And I think that's very important. We need to think about that when we are reading these books. You know, we can have a black person with all the data in the world, and we question, oh, well, I know you read it this way, but doesn't mean this, doesn't mean that. You know, he's saying, oh, this happened, and it's the law. I haven't heard any psychology degree. I haven't heard any. Yeah, everybody, if you went to college, you took the most people took a psychology class. I did that. Woo-woo. I haven't heard any degree, I haven't heard any training, I haven't heard, oh, I work with, I think the one person he talked about who was a licensed psychologist, Lenore Walker, I haven't looked her up, but I might think that this person means to be a black person, but I don't know. She has a generic name, but that was part of the team because all of a sudden she's a noted, but now she's, oh, we surprised us, part of the OJ team and discredit that person. And also, he doesn't talk about, and I think somebody just wrote this up recently, the other side of holding these perpetrators, he believes they're mostly men, these perpetrators accountable and kind of in that sense. And maybe he didn't do it in this book, but this should be like a balancing book saying the mind of these people, like these this book should be read with this book, and then together you have a clear picture of the situation so that someone can really be helped if that's your goal. But it's probably not because he doesn't, you know, you can't get justice from him. Thank you.
Very important line in the book. Other folks that we that had comments. Yes, sir. Was that okay. You, Mr. Demifor?
No, I was waiting until it stopped before I started.
Oh, okay.
But, I'll try to be brief. I just found it interesting that a couple of things. These abusive relationships seem to have a pattern. I guess the abuser starts out kind and gentle and in the beginning, and then eventually through the controlling part, being a control freak, you know, and need more and more power, I guess, and then eventually turn it physical. The TROs, temporary restraining orders, they, let's see, a TRO might ask one man to do something he could easily do, while it asks another to do something far more difficult. This distinction has been largely ignored by the criminal justice system. In other words, if there is an argument between a spouse, a male and a female, both residing in the same place, and a female takes out a TRO, then the male has to leave. Excuse me. At that point, then he may be put in a precarious situation. But if there was violence, well, nowadays, depending on the state, you don't actually have to be violent towards the other person. I think it's any unwanted touching and probably the word of the female to get a lot of males thrown out. The psychologist, Lenora Walker, is listed as American, so she's probably white. I thought it was interesting that although she coined the term the syndrome, domestic violence syndrome, and she was a well-known expert in this field. When she joined O.J. Simpson's team, then she was just flat-out wrong, according to him. And so I'll leave my line on that, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery. Do we have other folks? Questions, comments they want to make sure they get in, especially if anybody wants to make sure. Gus T, you are talking crazy. Women's shelters, Underground Railroad, same thing.
Any other comments, folks, when you get in?
Russ, can you tell me?
Thanks, sir.
Oh, I just want to know where that reference is, the shelters and the underground railroad.
It's in chapter 10. And let's see, I can give you, well, I have the ebooks. So I won't be able to give like specific page, but it's, so for me, this is like kind of the midpoint of chapter 10. I'm trying to see if there's a headline that it's close to. So if you have the book in chapter 10, in my version, there's boldface print and italics where he says the first time a woman is hit, she is a victim. And the second time she is a volunteer. There's a break with three dots on the page shortly after that. After that break, it should be about a page or so over. We said the first paragraph in Los Angeles, we have a hotline that automatically connects callers to the nearest shelter. And then a few sentences down from there, bang, the modern day Underground Railroad how to choose the best time to run and how not to be tracked when they escape into the modern day Underground Railroad that shelters have become. There's the sentence. Let's see. Thomas in New York, did you have a comment or question?
Thank you.
Yes, sir, Mr. Demery Four. Was that Thomas in New York or someone else who had a comment they were trying to get in that we missed?
Yeah, Josh, I had something else to say. I'm glad I listened tonight to the book club because, you know, it kind of gave me some ammunition here. The whole feminist, you know, thing, which comes a topic that, you know, sometimes you get into with black women, trying to compare the plight of women to the plight of black people. And I just think this was great to hear, you know, like if you have an abusive husband who had a gun to your head, you know, you got a black eye and a broken nose and you go to a battered woman's shelter, it'll be the equivalent of going to one that your husband owns and he's the director of it when you get there. You know, like that's our situation, you know. It's no buffer. I like what the caller said. He said, I put it in my own words, but logic based off of inductive reasoning, how we should be making decisions, not using intuitive reasoning. White people do not make their decisions based off of intuitions. You know, they get all the data, all the information, do all the research, and then they make the best decision for them to make. And that's how we should be making decisions, not intuition. However, you know, a post by a stranger or something, you know, that should also be logic, you know, not even intuition. Like, get away from me. You know, like, I just think that sets you up for failure. We should be making decisions based off of, you know, more than just intuition. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Was there anybody else who had a final comment they wanted to get in?
Can I respond to that a little bit? In Nebraska, Stuart, Nebraska.
Just give me 1 second. Did we miss anybody? Anybody who didn't get to share at all second time? You can get 30 seconds, caller in Nebraska.
Oh, it'll be quicker than that. I just wanted to say that intuition is needed. Intuition paint a picture for you to use your reason to make a sound judgment from. You know, westernized, Western culture, white supremacy, they tell you not to use the intuition, but you should learn how to read the intuition as a person and then make a sound judgment from that as to what you see and if that object, person, situation, whatever, is showing signs that it may be bad, or, you know, if it's showing signs that it may be good, then you make a judgment for that. So intuition is definitely key in sound judgment making. Mute my line.
Grand. I didn't share my thoughts from the second segment. Let's see what I can do briefly. One of the most important sentences in the book, what a person is doing now is the context for successful predictions. That, I think, is logic that is accurate. I found that frequently, a lot of times, people resist logic. Some, Dr. Welsing says sometimes victims of racism, we have difficulties accepting truth, that analyzing and accepting current behavior, that that can be very, very helpful in deducing what this person is likely to do. Want to know what they're going to do on Friday? Take a good look at Thursday. Not saying that's the totality, but Thursday can give you a lot of clues about what they're going to be doing on Friday. Let's see. He used the word terrorized again. As I said, James Loewen didn't even use the word terrorized that often. We're almost at the end of this book. And terrorized again. Words are important. I did think that that was super important for a variety of reasons. His sentence where he said, do not come here for justice, that he has a sign. He thought this was so important that he has a sign in his office to remind visitors, do not come here for justice. On a program where we generally end by saying, replace white supremacy with justice, his sign reads, do not come here for justice. Now, in one sense, then, hey, all right, we already know we can turn around. In the context that he presented it in terms of, I am here for safety, not justice. Now, that is an important distinction. I think, Emmy, she talked about the nuance. I think that is important in the context that he talked about, that some of the things that they do for quote unquote justice in these situations does not necessarily mean that you will be safe and that those may end up being two separate concerns. I thought that was important. Let's see. Yeah, and him mentioning, I felt like that's what I mean when he says before that he didn't come here to be an advocate with regards to the O.J. Simpson case. I feel like he lied to me. Because then you come out, you keep mentioning O.J. Simpson, and then you come all these pages later after you've admitted that you worked for the team, the prosecution. And then you mention this Lenore Walker and say that she surprised everybody by working for the O.J. defense team. In my view, he just brought her up to say she was wrong. It's a double entendre. She was wrong for working with that no good Negro O.J. Simpson. And she's wrong that there's no way to predict violence. I think it wasn't, you know, an exploration of her theory or why she joined the OJ defense team. It was just to bring her up as a straw. I think this would be what they call a straw figure, to bring her up just to bash her. Really, the underlying motive to bash her, her connection to OJ Simpson, but also so they can go along with supporting his theory that she is wrong, that you can, in fact, use patterns. I guess that'll be my final comment. That's something that we advocate on a regular basis and have for years. Dr. Welsing talked about that pattern recognition, that you can look at behaviors, particularly groups, clusters of behaviors, and discern patterns. You can do that. That is a part of human intelligence, and you certainly can look at the global centuries, generations of collective white behavior, white men, white women, white children, and see enormous patterns about how they treat black people. Absolutely qualifies as abuse and terrorism. We'll wrap there. Tomorrow is Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I think we have about two more sessions on this book. You can drop an email if you have archived comments, questions. I was a little late getting the upload of the book club session for last week uploaded, the Workplace Racism. I was sick. Man, I have the utmost respect for attempted parents. I had not even really factored in frequently if the children get sick. You might also get sick. Man. On the Mend program should be uploaded shortly after we are done. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. He mentioned that in the book, alcohol use and then using that as an excuse for violent, incorrect behavior. Sobriety would be best. Talk about that on a regular basis on this broadcast.
In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with enforcement officials, badge or no. Let's also stay off the cell phone if we are driving, doing all that we can to minimize unnecessary problems. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. A victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.